Good morning, everybody, and welcome to the Wednesday, May 25th, 2022 ADA board meeting. It is 10:48. I'll call the meeting to order. Now I'm sure I need to do a roll call of the board members, please.
Mr. Ellis?
Here.
Mr. Kendi?
Here.
Mr. Fogel?
Here.
Mr. Biebermore?
Here.
Mr. Mitchell?
Here.
Chair Proof?
Here.
All are present.
Thank you. Item number three is the agenda.
To move to approve the agenda as presented.
Mr. Chairman, this is Albert. I'll second.
Thank you. Any discussion on the agenda? Any additions? Ellen, any additions, corrections? Is there any objection to approving the agenda as presented? Hearing none, the agenda is approved. Item number four is prior minutes for April 13th, 2022.
I move the prior minutes April 13th, 2022.
Mr. Chairman, this is Albert. I'll second.
Thank you. Is there a discussion on the minutes for April 13th? Corrections, deletions, clarifications?
Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Great deal. Page 6, second paragraph. Was there a Nev or a Mitchell that should be after that Mr.?
Mr. Discuss for the record.
Yes, sir.
Well, either maybe Mr. Let's see. Who is it?
That
would be Mr. Neff. Okay. So let's add Mr. Neff into that.
That's all I have.
Thank you, Randy. Any further clarifications? Is there any objections to this? Minutes are approved for April 13th. Bring us to item number 5, public comments. Please limit to 2 minutes per person. Speak your name clearly, and if you have an affiliation for our records, and we'd ask that you speak to the business on the agenda for today. Any of you, have anybody online?
No, Chair, I see no callers on the line. Excuse me, there is one caller on the line.
Yes, hello. This is Mayor Bryce Ward with the Fairbanks North Star Borough.
Welcome. Thank you, Mayor. Go ahead.
Yes, I'd like to provide comments today in regards to the development efforts for residential property in the North Pole area. The borough's been working with the ADA team to develop a housing tax incentive for that particular property, and just wanted to provide my support for the concept of doing the civil work and improvements for that property to provide residential opportunities for developers in the interior. We are working, you have to go through an approval process with the Fairbanks North Star Borough Assembly for that exemption, and I understand based on conversations with your director that is a critical piece to the development of that potential, of that property, and make this available for the market. So we certainly want to be responsive and let you know that we are working with your board. We do need information on the development plans, and as those get more finalized with the project team and then eventually approved by the board, we are excited about being able to share that with the assembly. Again, I would just reiterate that our exemption process requires that we go through that assembly approval, and we do need some of that information decided before we go back to them for that exemption. But all in all, I applaud the efforts of ADA to come up with a site development plan like this that allows for developers to take advantage of that at public infrastructure where it most likely would not be or currently is not being provided for by the private market. So I think there's certainly much to be benefited in the community, and we are certainly still in need of housing. We've had about 25 applications for housing come in through our existing exemption program. They're scheduled for approval on Thursday. And then we've got about another 28 to 30 that have been applied for. But we still have not seen the large-scale developments like Ada is talking about come through the exemption program. So we are certainly in need of that housing still. That concludes my comments. Unless there's questions.
Thank you, Mayor. All right. Any further? One more?
I'm sorry?
Hi. Hi, good morning. My name is Melissa Fuller. This is the New River Coalition. For others on the phone who are trying to remember how to comment, it's star 9. Others are trying to figure that out, too. To raise your hand. I'm calling in about the West New Village, which is on your agenda today, and the notice that you sent out this week that you started the public, the NEPA 404 permitting process. Just want to say how disappointing it is you guys didn't wait for the cost-benefit analysis to be completed by both the state and the one that we've heard that you are doing. And this just highlights why the public has such little faith in Ada at the moment and what a potential another misinvestment this is on behalf of Ada. I think the borough outreach was fantastic. That was recently done and shows opposition strongly to this road as a road in general and super strong opposition as a private road, which is what it's budgeted for right now. I think the on the heels of the recent report that comes out about Alaskan mega projects upstate showing that Ada has a potential loss of $3.2 billion since 1970 due to poorly invested projects and funds. This just ties directly into that. And just wanted to let you all know that the public is paying attention and we continue to be highly disappointed in your actions around this project. Thank you.
Next comment.
Chair, there are no further members.
All right. Is there anybody in the boardroom wishing to make a comment? No? All right. I'll close the public comment section. Alan, any rebuttal or comments would you like to make?
Well, first I would really like to thank Mayor Ward for his comments and for the work that he's really undertaking in identifying a way for us to achieve a property tax exemption that works with the investment plan that we're putting forward. So I really appreciate, and he's been very proactive, his team there has been very proactive with us, and we'll provide a little more update to that. With regard to the comments kind of from Lisa Hoyer, who's the executive director for the Pacific River Coalition, we have had comments before from her. We've also had direct discussions with her. I've had direct discussions with her. We understand her position, where she's coming from. The application and the information that we're providing around the application and the notification about that identifies the fact that it's initiating subject to the Corps. It's been submitted to the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. Subject to their acceptance of the application and decision on the process we would be undertaking with it, that in itself is a public engagement process in reviewing all the issues around the permit that we're asking for. We'll get into detail in the director comments as well with the update on that this is part of our obligation under state statute in ensuring that Alaska's resources are being utilized with the best elements of conservation and utilization for Alaskans. So this is all part of that effort in ensuring that there's a full review of the opportunity that this road provides. Thank you, Chair.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Alan.
This is Albert.
Albert.
Could you talk to Melissa Hoyer's comment about the $3.2 billion losses that Ada has incurred over its history? I'm not able to amount through the chair, Board Member Fogel. I do not believe it's true. I have not read the economic report that she is referring to. I do know from our own information that Ada, since its inception in 1967, has directed $3.5 billion into the
into economic development within the state through all of, across all of our programs. That's including our conduit revenue bond program, our direct project investments, our loan participation program. And during that same time, as board member, you're aware, we have been declaring dividends since 1997 and have returned close to $450 million to the state. I look at our income statements, I look at our financial statements, which are available for any member of the public to review on data. We're a state corporation. We have consistently, again since 1997 with the declaration of the dividend, shown a net profit, a net income from our operations. We've shown operating profit. So the accumulation of $3.2 billion, which I believe was referenced, I do not see within our financial statements, I do not see it being aware of any projects that we've ultimately engaged in or invested in. So, again, I'm unaware of how the analysis was done, but from the information I have available to me and the public has available directly from our own reports, that would not be the case.
Thank you, Mr. Weisner. Are you able to get access to this so-called report, share it with the board and also our legal team?
Through the chair, board member Fogle, I will follow up on that and I'll make sure that each board member gets a copy of that and that we'll also have discussions with the Department of Law.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Al Calvert. And I will make the comment for the record that just as important is the return on investment of the bottom line is putting Alaskans to work on a long-term basis. And we take that into account in every investment or project we partner with. And so that's very important, and you are not going to see that in the financial statement. So there's thousands of jobs in the state of Alaska, particularly connected to ADA and its involvement for the last 50 years. So I just want to put that on the record. All right, so I'll close public comments. New business under A, Calvin presentation, fixed income market, U.S. macro update. Calvin?
So, Chair and board members, following last month's board meeting, it was requested that we get an update from our external advisor on our fixed income investments, and that would be Callan. We have Al Ford, who's online with us with Teams to make a presentation. So I want to generally introduce him joining us, and you've met him before with other presentations. But I do want to hand it over to our Chief Investment Officer, Morgan Neff, who's had the close association with Alex and really have identified, you know, the issues to be raised through the presentation.
Welcome, Alex and Morgan.
Good morning, Chair. Good morning, Board. Good morning, Alex.
Mr. Chairman, before we begin, could Alan please, and Morgan at the end of this presentation, could you give an update to the Board of our divestiture of the banks and investment firms that are not willing to do business in the Arctic?
We would need to take a recess to discuss that point.
Well, we can do that after the presentation.
Okay.
Good morning, everyone. Pursuant to the last board meeting, the board requested that we reinstate the in-person annual reviews. And I know that, Alex, that's not a unique request from Ada. I know that she's been on the road quite frequently for that request, and it's been a couple of years since she's been in front of your institutional clients. Due to scheduling, Alex could not be here to provide the in-person review of performance, so we decided to modify this and allow him to provide the board a macro and fixed income update due to the recent volatility in all the markets. As we sit here today, you know, the equity market, depending on what you're looking at, is down either 28 or 18%. There's been a rise in rates, which has also corresponded to fixed income performance. But with that, Alex has committed to returning on August 3rd board meeting to provide the annual review of performance that will also tie directly into the macro and fixed income update he's providing today. With that, I'd like to briefly introduce Alex for the board, new board members that have not met him yet. Alex has been in the consulting business for in excess of 13 years. He was previously with Wilshire Associates, and he was named as Vice President of Cowen's Denver Consulting Office in 2019. He works with a variety of clients, including many within Alaska, and provides strategic planning, asset allocation, investment structure management, search and selection, performance evaluation, and continuing education and research. With that, Alex, would you like to provide a little bit of intro to Cowen in itself, and I leave it to you.
Great. Thank you, Morgan, and good morning, Chairman, board members. Great to be with you again virtually, and look forward to seeing you in person in August. So, you know, for those who I haven't had a chance to meet yet, my name is Alex Ford. I'm from your external investment advisor. The name of our firm is Cowen. We have offices all over the country. I'm based in Denver. We work with a diverse range of clients, including funds like yourself, retirement plans, public, private, and the like. And really our value add to the board is helping you source your investment managers, monitor them on an ongoing basis, you know, with investment structure work, asset allocation work, and then also reporting, which is an important function for the board, periodically to check in how you're doing. Are you meeting your objectives? And then lastly, I think that's also helpful for the board. We provide context. So for today, we're going to look at the markets and fixed income specifically and see what's been going on, and that should set some background for the results you're seeing.
Thanks, Alex. Before we proceed, does any of the board or chair have any questions for Alex? Sure. Thanks, Alex. Please move forward with the presentation.
Okay, great. Now, Morgan, would you like me to pull this up on screen as well?
If you would like, that way anybody that's following online can also see as you're going through the presentation. If it's not too much of an issue for you to drive.
I don't mind. It does look like that function is enabled yet for me to share material, so either you know, I can do it, or if anyone else wants to, I can call out page numbers. Or if you all have it in front of you, we can just proceed whatever the desire of the board is.
Yep. Which one is it?
On screen would be great if possible.
Okay, see options? All right, here. Push that down. No, that's over the lobby. Who can present? So down one more. Mm-hmm. Down one more. Mm-hmm. That push up there. Everyone.
Okay.
And take that look. Okay, Alex,
you
should have that functionality now to throw it up on the screen.
Yeah.
Thanks.
All right, I see that now. Thank you. Now hopefully you can all see this on screen. Now, as Morgan mentioned, you know, we kind of broke this into two sections. The first will be fairly brief. It's kind of more of our standard market update, looks at the economy and all of the asset classes typically. You guys do not invest fully in fixed income, so our plan was to kind of transition away from that fairly quickly and do more of a deeper dive and overview of the fixed income market itself, and see, you know, what has happened recently and what are our expectations for going forward. And then lastly, you know, if there's desire or time, I do have some information on inflation that we can touch on, you know, if need be, and what's going on in that front. So please, you know, interrupt me along the way. Please ask questions where you'd like, and happy to make this as interactive as possible. But we'll get started right away on page 3. And so this is just a, you know, nice snapshot or dashboard, if you will, of the U.S. economy writ large. really across a couple of different quadrants. And these think of as, you know, macroeconomic drivers of the returns you see for fixed income, for equities, and for other asset classes. Now, we'll start in the bottom right. This looks at GDP. So this is a quarter-by-quarter measure of the U.S. economy on an annual basis. Is it growing or contracting? And, you know, as you all know, coming out of the bottom of the COVID pandemic, we have seen some pretty strong growth rates quarter-by-quarter-by-quarter. That continues through the end of 2021. However, as we rolled into the first quarter of 2022, we actually saw a bit of a contraction in the economy. You see that -1.4% down. First time the economy contracted since, you know, 2020, when the pandemic really took hold. So is that a cause for concern? You know, we don't really think so. It's more of a blip in the road. And we think it's kind of easily explained by some one-time effects. So for example, up until the end of last year, inventory reinvestment had really been a tailwind for economic growth. Retailers and you know, all sellers of goods have really depleted their inventories, had trouble stocking back up because of supply chain issues, and so all of that, you know, helped push economic growth. That was a one-time effect because inventories are now, you know, where they needed to be, and now it's more maintenance going forward. Our net exports, so our trade balance, continued to grow as a deficit, and that has a negative effect on our economic growth here at home. But that's been a long-running feature of our economy. And then, of course, there was a drop in federal government spending, as well as a lot of state and local governments as well, as a lot of the fiscal stimulus, a lot of the support that was given as a result of the pandemic started to roll off, and those programs started to end. So when you sum those three factors up, that's why you're seeing a bit of a drop in the economy. The bottom line is that the consumer, you know, continues to be strong, and the consumer drives 70+% of our economy. Consumer spending was actually up on a real and nominal basis in the first quarter, even with that high inflation. And so I think there is still some fairly strong health to the U.S. economy, and we should see a return to positive trend growth, you know, going forward. So that's not really the big story today. What is of course, if you look to the top, inflation. So the chart on the top shows various measures of inflation. I think the most common and the one that we'll talk about is CPI, and that's the dark blue line. But really any measure is red hot, essentially off the charts. CPI at 40-year highs. It was 8.5% on an annual increase in prices at the end of March. As we moved into April, that number was 8.3%. So, you know, is it leveling off? Is it going to start declining? That's yet to be seen. But in any event, these numbers are incredibly high. You know, the Fed has spent much of 2021 using the word transitory to refer to inflation, and that has since been, you know, abandoned or retired. We're now seeing that this is a bit more persistent than perhaps the Fed had initially anticipated. Supply chain issues continue to linger, having an impact on getting goods to market. And so they've really pivoted, and they've become much more aggressive and hawkish in their response. And they really have a couple of ways of doing that. And the first is, if you move to the chart on the bottom left, is we look at interest rates. This is a yield curve at different time periods. The dark blue is the yield curve as of the end of the first quarter 2022. The teal is the end of 2021. And then the orange is where it was a year ago. And so one of the things the Fed is doing, because they have the unenviable task of cooling off the economy, bringing price increases down without crashing us into a recession, is they're increasing interest rates on the short end. They're making the cost of money more expensive. Credit cards, mortgages, everything like that is becoming more expensive. And so you'll see this blue line really start to spike up. That's the Fed's intervention. They're increasing interest rates on the short end. And the expectation is that interest rates over the longer end, which they do not directly control, will also increase. And you're not yet really seeing that materialize, resulting in this funny shape to the yield curve, where the short end and the long end are kind of at parity. And that's an unusual feature of interest rates. So we don't expect that to persist.
Hey, Alex, this is Morgan. Typically, when you see an inversion of that yield curve where the forward rates or the shorter rates invert above the longer rates, that has never failed to indicate whether it's an extended or a brief period of recession, right?
That's right. And so you may see this in the news, particularly in financial media. A lot of people are talking about the yield curve for that very reason, is that when shorter-term rates, and usually it's the 2-year versus the 10-year, but there's different measures. When they invert, meaning the shorter term is higher than the longer term, that has always pre-staged a recession historically. So it's a bit of a flashing warning sign, but the important thing is to put that in context. The time from when it inverts to an actual recession can be anywhere from 6 months to 3 years. And the performance of markets in that period can be quite good. So while it suggests some clouds on the horizon, it's really not a warning sign to change your approach. But this, of course, has all kinds of impacts for bond investors.
Alex,
right,
Board Member Fogel was asking a question. I'm sorry.
Sorry, just to interrupt for a second. How much time do we allocate for this presentation?
Alex is here at the board's pleasure, so however long the board would like Alex to go through the presentation, it's up to you.
Mr. Chairman, how much time do you want to allocate for this presentation? Okay.
Okay. Alex, I don't know if you heard the chair. He would like to conclude the presentation by 11:30 in 15 minutes.
Okay.
Thank you.
No problem at all. That's great, and thank you for that. So we'll flip ahead. That's kind of the backdrop of the economy. Page 4 for your pleasure. A few bullet points about what's going on here at home and outside the U.S. As well. Of course, the war in Ukraine weighing heavily on markets and a lot related to China. Also weighing on markets. And so what does it look like across markets for the first quarter? You can see there was really nowhere to hide. Nobody sugarcoated 2022 off to a real rough start. And what's unusual about this environment is that both equities at the top and bonds are down at the same time. That's not something you see typically historically. So it's been a challenging environment for institutional investors. So the few bright spots being private real estate, and of course commodities led by energy. But otherwise, there's been a bit of a pain and not a lot of places to escape so far this year. This is from the end of March. The pain continues as you move through towards the end of May, and we're still seeing negative returns quarter to date after March. On page 6, looks at just the different asset classes, how they perform over time. Your asset class will be that dark green box, U.S. fixed income. We know it tends to lag equities, of course, but there are periods when it is, among the best performers, and that's usually when we see spiking volatility.
Yeah. Alex, if I could ask, this is Alan Weissner, if I could ask, could you concentrate, given that we have 10 minutes, could you concentrate on the U.S. fixed income structure and what it represents, what you're seeing there, what you're covering, because I think that's most pertinent ultimately to our externally managed funds.
Absolutely. So we'll jump ahead a few pages. That was kind of the broad overview of the markets and the economy. On page 10 now, we're in the next section looking at fixed income, U.S. fixed income specifically, which you invest in. So the aggregate is the Bloomberg Aggregate Bond Index. This is the proxy for the bond market. This is what your two external managers benchmark themselves against. And you can see how it's composed. So the bulk of it is in U.S. Treasuries and government-related agencies. That's almost half. And then there are other exposures to corporate credit or mortgage-backed securities. So you are diversified across these economic sectors. The characteristics of the benchmark index on which your managers source their investments are on the page. The keynote is it's a fixed rate debt, it's all in dollars, it's publicly issued, and it's high quality. So they do not include high yield or non-investment grade securities, and nothing really outside the U.S. Your managers, Alessa Permanent and Barrow Hanley, are fairly conservative. There is another style of fixed income called Core Plus, where those managers may introduce high yield or non-investment grade or bonds outside the U.S. to the mix. But you do not yet currently have those types of strategies in the externally managed portfolio. That's something perhaps to consider for the future. You know, this page, you've seen iterations of this in the past. This just looks at fixed income. When does it tend to add value is when everything else is doing bad. So you'll see the S&P 500 over these various historical periods selling off. Those are very painful times for investors. That's when the Bloomberg aggregate, the dark blue, your bond managers tend to hold value. So you're really preserving principal through time so that you can fund, you know, investments in the state rather than, you know, incurring these deep drawdowns periodically. Now, I want to look at the bond market broadly on 14 and just look at some performance. So if you've looked at performance reports, you may be familiar with these numbers. It's been a challenging environment, and this is mostly driven by the increasing interest rates that we've seen. Because as rates go up, bond prices move in the opposite direction, so over the near term, you have that negative total return. The Bloomberg aggregate, you can see negative 5.9 for the quarter, negative 4.2 for the year at the bottom. And then the other various sectors. So I'll point out, you know, long government credit has much higher duration, much higher sensitivity to interest rates, and therefore suffered a steeper loss in this period, negative 11%. TIPS at the bottom over the year are tied to inflation. And with inflation still high, they've done quite well, 4.3% positive return. So that's how the fixed income market looks. On 16, what are we expecting for the future? Well, we know the Fed is trying to be more aggressive with hiking rates, and these are some market-based expectations of where rates are going. And you can see that the expectation is that rates are going to increase quite steeply and quite dramatically. And so we've already had two hikes this year at the Fed met, and we may see anywhere from 7 to 9 hikes in total this year, with potentially more in 2023. Now, why has this been painful? On this chart, we're looking at almost 4 years of history of the bond market. You can see that dark blue line is the effective yield. That's really been in a secular decline for 40 years. Now, that's been good for bond prices, but it really reached the lows at the end of 2021. You're not generating a lot of income as of the end of 2021 on bond holdings. Yet the effective duration is 6.6. That's the risk. That's your sensitivity to interest rates. It's high, relatively speaking. So you don't have a lot of cushion as rates rise. And this is why this has been a painful and typical environment for fixed income today. Now, the thing to keep in mind is that as your bonds mature, if you stay invested, you'll be able to reinvest those at higher yields. That's down the road, and that will eventually outweigh any negative, you know, price depreciation, leading to a positive total return.
Which would also, also include the active manager not only utilizing the market and reinvesting at higher rates, but also looking at the curve and rolling up or down it based on the relative value and the return potential on that portion of the curve, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's the value of your active managers is the difficulty is what the market is giving is your managers can add some value above and beyond that, also with potentially lower risk. So in the interest of time, I really want to jump ahead to 20 because I think this is a great slide to set expectations. So this looks forward over the next decade. And briefly, the different colored bars are kind of the different components of a total return. So the bond investor, you get yield, that's your income. You get capital appreciation, that's the bond price itself. And then there are these other components, downgrades, roll yield. Those all sum up to the green bar, which is total return. And what you'll notice in the top is that the teal bar, that's the capital appreciation, is negative. That's because bond prices and interest rates move in opposite directions. So, you know, that's a bit of a painful thing. But the yield is steadily increasing. And so you get to a point where the higher yield begins to outweigh the capital depreciation, and your total return, the sum of those two parts, you know, is marching higher as you look out to the horizon as you stay invested. What's interesting is that because rates have moved so aggressively this year, the bottom chart really shows you, you took a lot of your loans early. We're taking a lot of our pain in 2022. That's why you see the teal bar -8%. And you kind of get that out of the way, and you get the benefit over the next ensuing years from a higher income, vastly outweighing any capital depreciation. So while this is painful right now, it's near term, and going forward, the expectation is, you know, you're going to again see positive total return.
Alex, the shares asked if this is our actual portfolio, and I can answer, you can answer, but this is the aggregate, right?
That's correct. Yes, sir. This is just the market itself, not your portfolio.
Which our portfolio has been directly correlated to the ag, which has been
a big
one.
That's correct. I'm going to ask some real quick questions here. Maybe speed this up. I'm not a financial guy, but obviously the industry has been talking about an increase in interest rates for over a year now, and I assume money managers understand that when the government prints money and spends a lot of money, it puts pressure on inflation. So my question is, what did we do 6 months ago or 9 months ago with our portfolio to head this off? Or did we do anything?
That's a good question. Your managers did take some positioning in anticipation of increasing interest rates. So if you look at their measures of the ratio, which is sensitivity to interest rates, they tend to be lower than the aggregate index, than the benchmark, meaning they don't draw down as much as the index itself going into this environment, you know, because they, as you alluded to, kind of foresaw the writing on the wall. And they do take active positioning in sectors in anticipation of, you know, higher inflation, right? But they can't really escape this backdrop. You know, they do have to invest in fixed income. This is kind of the sandbox in which they are dealt. But their performance has done better than the benchmark.
So to measure the performance, what I would be looking for in the quarterly reports is, have we not changed directions versus changing directions? One of the things we can do to judge whether or not our managers are doing their job is to see the difference, and that they're actively doing it. I mean, as a layman in this world, understanding that this financial stuff, that gives me that if they've done nothing or what they're actively doing, I can see, had they not done anything or they've been status quo and not doing anything versus what they've done and they're actively managing.
Yeah, so there's an active, Chair, there's an active management benchmark called the information ratio that we can have analyzed and run that would show the manager's performance as an active manager versus it just being status quo and benchmark, and that I believe would give you what you're looking for.
Yeah, as long as it's related to our investment.
Yeah,
our,
correct. Yes.
What I would add to Sound Watcher is that Calendar's reports that are provided quarterly, we can show you where that information is provided because they compare it to the benchmarks.
And I'm worried about what benchmarks are. I really care about our portfolio, not the rest of the
world. But that's how you evaluate and get to answering the question you're specifically asking, because our portfolio is, as highlighted by Mr. Ford, is limited to fixed income securities. And so it plays in that specific pool of available returns. And we have actual returns that are on that portfolio, which then you compare it to the average or the benchmarks in place. And if you perform better than the benchmarks, then it's showing that your active management is doing better than just, you know, effectively buying
it. They have nothing to compare it to if they have done nothing.
That is,
I agree with the benchmarks, but I want to know the difference. When they make a decision to change our portfolio, what if they had made the decision as they move? I understand that they're putting themselves against a benchmark. That's what they're. But I want to analyze if they've done nothing. Does that make sense?
It does. What we'll do is there are relative reports that can show their attribution as an active manager versus.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because that's how much value, you know. The whole industry is probably doing it, but it gives us an idea if they're doing better than industry against benchmarks. But
right.
With our particular.
Those are. I'm sorry.
No, they're badass.
No. Those are how. That's how we review the quarterly reports anyways, is looking at not only absolute but relative performance of each manager. So we're already conducting that review with the information, but that is something we will make sure that is lined out at the August 3rd annual review with Alex.
And typically, you would give your manager a mandate, and so you would give them a benchmark that they are targeting, and then they have allowances to be short or long to that benchmark. And those are the types of differential plays they can make that can add value. And so I expect that we were short to the benchmark. That's why we're beating the benchmark. We had securities that weren't as long alive as the benchmark had. Therefore, we don't have as much exposure to rising interest rates. But it you have to be cognizant of the limitations. A manager's not going to double down on the benchmark.
That's correct. So all fixed income managers are negative right now, right? They can't escape this environment, but some are doing better than others.
Well, I'd say the only one that's doing better is leveraged loans because of the floating aspect of that asset class, which is why real estate loans typically have done very well, just because you don't have a fixed rate there.
That's going to change with the market, the economy.
Alex, we're coming up on the 11:30 mark, and I just want to make sure we're cognizant of the board's time. If the board would like to go ahead and, if they've got any more questions or if they'd like Alex to continue on any additional slides, please, would you let them know? No?
Mr. Chairman, this is Albert. I would just request that the August 3rd meeting be very succinct to our organization and how we're impacted by the market and how we've had our returns. And we don't really necessarily need a market overview, but really focused in on our organization.
Yeah, Chair, thank you, Board Member Fuller. That's why we wanted to take this opportunity before he was able to come in person,
yeah,
to give a little bit of that macro landscape and that backdrop. So we appreciate the board allowing that to happen.
It might be good just to shoot an outline of what he is preparing to present on August 3rd to you.
Okay.
To make sure that it's relevant to what the board is going to want to talk about. And I can help review that with you if you want.
That sounds good. And we'll make sure any other additional information you'd like to see in that report is included.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay. Thank you, Alex. I think that's I don't see anybody on the line, the board members raising their hand.
Great.
Thank you, Alex.
Thank
really appreciate it.
Thank you. Okay, brings us to item number 7, Old Business Resolution L2201.
Mr. Chairman, given the discussion that was last month with the approval of Resolution number L2201, we did want to come back, based on the discussion about the requirements that were put in place with the Phase 2 on the property, and have an update really for the board on the conclusions on that, those discussions with the borrower. So I would ask Tiffany Jansen if she would join and provide an update to the board, please.
Good morning, members. Tiffany Jansen, commercial plan instructor. Yes, I did speak with Nordstrom about the phase two requirement. The borrower has decided to move forward with the phase two, so we have heard from their environmental engineer, Shannon Wilson, which will be conducting that. The borrower has elected not to commit to the loan until they have received the phase two act and we have deemed it satisfactory to the authority. So we have made their commitment letter for June 20th now.
Okay. Thank you.
All right.
So if there are any other questions, then we would go on to Director Thomas. So this is Chairman, Board Members, under Director Comments, item agenda 8A, we have several of the projects to provide updates to the board. We've also included and attached to the agenda, a link to the agenda, certain documents that are related to the different projects. But for a broad element, this is a verbal update and being able to address any specific questions the board has at this point in time on these projects. So we're looking to talk specifically about the North Pole Military Facility Zone land development that Mayor Ward had made some comments on earlier in public comments. Also talking about the Amber Access Project, the Western Sentinel Access Project as an update, and the Alaska Ship and Dry Dock. So what I would like to start off first is going through some of the update information for the North Pole Military Facilities on land development. And for that, I would like to ask if Angela Case would join me and Morgan Neff, if you would be available. Also, Bill Bibblemore, a board member who's been working with us, is online and able to also provide some comments or mention or answer several questions. So at this stage, let me first address and again thank Mayor Ward for his participation in public comment and what he was identifying, and really want to thank him and his team for the support that they've been providing us as we've been progressing on this. What is specifically at issue and what I'd like to identify is that under ordinance in February and then again in...
I appreciate that. I think that's, we just concisely, what are the issues that we have to work through on getting it to the finish line and if there is alternatives or whatever.
The critical issue related to this is the property tax abatement. So the current ordinance within the Fairbanks North Star Borough that was approved for broader development does not apply to the way that we're structuring the development. So what I would like to briefly do, again, because we have public that's joined us and this has a lot of focus, is structurally we're talking about having a partnership with the city of North Pole who would contribute land, acquire the land, contribute to ADA, and ADA would invest in the underlying utility connections to water service, electrical, wastewater, the heating sources ultimately for the housing units, and we would do the master planning for the land. We would then define certain lots that would be available to various and multiple housing contractors under a consistent design and known unit, spaces be between one bedroom, two bedroom, and three bedroom, but they are predominantly viewed to be two bedroom at this point. For
the better term, a plan development.
Yeah. The master plan is ultimately what we're putting in place for it and to attract housing contractors to it. So there's two stages that are here. It's our land development, which is initiating some element of construction, and then the housing unit construction itself. The way the property tax abatement is written, it would not apply to our development. The housing unit contractors would have to separately apply for the current ordinance or property tax exemption. So if we were able to come back to this board with a complete proposal, we would not have or be able to state distinctly that we have a property tax exemption on this development. So Mayor Ward and his team are working on that specific component now, where we should have, if it goes through the process and is approved by the Assembly, be able to present, and we're focusing on August 3rd at this point in time for that board meeting, to present a full proposal that does benefit from a property tax exemption of at least 10 years for the development, our improvements, and the housing builders' improvements. That's the first critical issue. The second critical issue is we're currently reviewing the land acquisition that has been delayed a bit, where we are ultimately doing a secondary assessment on the property itself, doing some core sampling. There is no known
contamination that is on the land itself, and that is from our initial phase one report that's been provided. There have been public comments talking about what is the known issue within the city of North Pole and Fairbanks North Star Borough of PFAS groundwater contamination. That is why we chose a property that is linked or directly adjacent and will be linked to city service and water provisions coming through that. So that will not affect the property development, and then development restrictions will be put in place to ensure that there is no breach of the groundwater plume. We can provide more detailed information if you have any questions on that. But that is one element that we're pursuing. The
only comment I would say on that, maybe Bill online can correct me, but if you have if you had PFAS on it, it may cloud each lot is being sold, even though you have the water and sewer, but at the end of the day, the property owner ultimately ADA could do a 99-year lease and take that completely out of the equation for the financing, long-term financing for a potential buyer.
Well,
is that right?
Just to make sure I understand your question, you're talking about if there is contamination due to the development. The highest risk in Angela, please step in. The highest risk of contamination during the development phase would be the installation of utilities. And there's an actual exemption and a process that they go through that exempts them from any kind of contamination.
No, I'm talking about the pre-existing condition, PFAS or hydrocarbons that are in North Pole because they're finally so close. I mean, the whole reason why I think North Pole has a water system to begin with. Because of the contamination from the refinery. That all being said, that's typically going to be a showstopper to a bank lending long term if the property has some contamination.
That's incorrect from the standpoint that there's been many homes that have been developed that have the same situation. It is exactly the issue that you just highlighted, that the water service is being provided by the city to address that issue, and financing has been put in place for independent lot development. What we can do, and we have the flexibility, and that's what part of our structure is that with the land development we're undertaking, we are structuring a longer-term recovery of that capital. But that's ultimately to benefit at a lower-cost investment from the housing contractors and the ability to have affordability for military personnel to these housing units.
Okay.
So the remaining issue that we're looking to address is a report that you have in front of you, which is related to the base allowance for housing that the military provides. And this is a report that was prepared predominantly by Morgan and Kyla was in pulling it together. It has been provided to our delegation and has also been part of questioning and testimony that Senator Murkowski has had with members of the military command, predominantly the Deputy Secretary for the Air Force and the military command for the Air Force, to address deficiencies in housing allowances that are being directly related to Fairbanks North Star Borough. And what I would briefly highlight is that
Fairbanks is less than Anchorage.
There is a 20% on average, in some cases over 26% based on certain rankings, lower allowance being paid in Fairbanks to the Military Housing Association in compared to the average. There's 5 military housing associations in the state of Alaska. Fairbanks is again, on with the mean 18%, but in certain categories, and these are the lower ranks, it's 26% difference to other military housing associations in Alaska. Well, what the research that Morgan is able to put together and really has highlighted is it's not supported by the underlying information and the rental rates that are in.
What?
If someone is joining us by Teams, if you can mute your side because we're getting feedback on our line here. Yeah. So we really identified that it is not supported by local data. In fact, housing rents within suitable housing rents or associated housing rents to what we're looking at facilitating have actually risen upwards of 6% over the last year. while the housing allowance itself was reduced by 3.5%. So that created a gap in on itself by 10% right there. And it's an issue that really needs to be addressed. It has been identified before by many parties that have been involved in the, within the community of how to ultimately get this housing developed with the early indications of the military personnel being relocated or identified for home vetting in Fairbanks. It is critical. We believe it's very critical to the success of the development we're looking to propose that the military recognizes this deficiency and corrects it very quickly.
If I can add one thing, Chair, it's not just what we're looking to do. I would think this is going to be nationally impactful for any developer looking to mobilize housing within that community. And we're starting to see some of the applications come in, and the numbers that they are putting within their applications, I can tell you, are not supported by the underlying BAW rates, the base allowance for housing rates, inclusive of utilities. Our analysis shows that Fairbanks continues to be one of the most costly places to live in Alaska, yet it doesn't it's not represented in the underlying allowance that the service members are being afforded. So we've done an extensive level of work alongside with Angela, and we're continuing to try to provide as much information as we can, but ultimately the analysis that you have before you is our consolidated and aggregate effort to show that we can't justify the delta between the two at this point.
So, Chair, what I think is the danger here, right, with the information in place, if it's not corrected, then the housing that Fairbanks North Star Borough has been very proactive with their property tax abatement to raise from these other developers will not meet the military requirements. The military will not be able to afford that housing, which puts even more emphasis on the development that we're focused on.
But can you explain the 10% disparity again? Can you explain that one more time for me?
The BAH, the housing allowance that we're referring to, is the calculation for that is supposed to be supported by the underlying rental market.
Mm-hmm.
And it's supposed to meet certain criteria as far as acceptability, which if there's not this high level of acceptability, it just needs to be adequate housing. The delta or the difference that we're seeing here is not supported in the third-party data, rental data that we're getting from HFC, the labor force and work development. Oh, I'm sorry.
Rent went up 6%
over the last 3 years, and then the BAH has actually been adjusted downward.
So it's not correlating, and we saw in all the other military housing association markets, which is Juneau, Sitka, Kodiak, Anchorage, and Fairbanks. Or am I adding?
No.
The other housing allowances went up.
Fairbanks remains an anomaly.
Is there a reason why?
We don't have data to support that reason. We've been trying to work with the third-party contractor on getting their supportive data. We just do not have it. We're using all of the available data that's available to us from the Labor and Workforce Development, AHSC, as well as the... We've asked multiple times.
Yeah.
I think it's a historical metric that real estate in Fairbanks was historically less expensive than other markets listed in this report. But in recent times, it's not just the vacancy, it's not just the allowance, it's the vacancy rate. Because I went to an HSC board meeting last month, and they indicated that the vacancy rate had gone from double digits to single digits. And, of course, the last year as well, 20% to 5% sort of change. And so there's been a significant market change, and I think as a result, it's just trying to catch up.
Well, I mean, we went back and historically analyzed the rental data, and Fairbanks has consistently been aligned with the other five military housing areas that are assigned housing allowance. We've tried to examine every approach, board member, and we just have yet to be able to get the supportive data to show that Fairbanks should be that.
Just have the anecdotal, I have two next. Yeah.
Yeah.
No,
So we got Sullivan and Murkowski working on this?
Yeah, we do, and we have their staffs heavily involved in this. They have the report that you have, and they shared it with the military command in Washington. So we're really trying to get, in our case, what we've identified to that staff is that we need to have something definitive.
Is it helpful if we reach out, if the board members reach out individually to their offices just to also check on the status?
It's always helpful in that case. Thank you.
Okay.
I would ask, if I may, Angela, is there anything that I have not raised that we need to raise at this point in time?
I think you covered it. You continue to progress. The soil samples were taken on Monday and have been sent to the lab, and so I will get an update on the receipt and the duration of the analysis. So that's something that we're aware that would be of assistance to the City of North Polk City Council members in preparing to complete the ordinance that will allow purchase of the property.
So if I may then suggest we take a break, that lunch is here, and then we can pick up with the other project updates.
Okay, so it's 10 to 12, 15 minutes.
Mr. Chairman.
Albert.
Julie, do you have a question first?
Oh, thank you, sir.
Commissioner Sandy.
Was there a timeline that I missed? Like, so I know that you guys have been working with the delegation's offices on this. Is there a window of time where if we don't get a response or if there isn't action taken that the project will die?
Through the chair, Board Member Sandy, what we've identified to our delegation staff and through the conversations as well with our partners at the Fairbanks North Shore Borough and with the City of North Pole is that we're focusing on really having an August 3rd board meeting to be able to present a proposal for your review to achieve final investment decision to initiate the project development. So if there's an element or a deadline to say at this point in time it's no go, we can keep pushing out the date. However, what it does, it has a ramification on when that housing will be earliest available. We're already, and I'll be very frank, we're already pushing the boundaries of having housing available by fall of 2023. And if we do need to extend into the BAH rates are published in December, and if we are obligated to wait until the end of December for those new rates to be published, or if there's no change in those rates, then we're not in a position to be able to present a proposal for review by the board that is economically feasible. So it's an element of just continuing to push out when these housing units would be available.
Mr. Chairman. Thank you for this presentation. Morgan and Alan, at what rank did you see if the BAH allowance would be feasible to purchase these properties? Typically, you know, E5 and below are on base. So maybe E6s that have dependents are going to be off base. And definitely officers, so O1 and above, are going to be off base for housing. So I'm just wondering where you pegged your analysis.
If I could give it some general comments, and then I would ask Morgan if he could give some detail, because you've done the full analysis on those ranks. But first off, I do want to highlight the intention of the property development is for lease. And that's coming from military command within us.
It's for what?
It's for lease, not for home purchase. So they have really clarified the fact that the demand from the personnel side is for lease property. So we would need home builders, contractors, and investors in the property and make it available. So just to define that side of it. The other side of it is that there is an actual reduction in on-base housing that is occurring. And that is also through direct discussions with the Eielson Air Force Base Command. Part of that involves the environmental impact statement you'll see in there, where they're actually reducing elements of on-base housing
to accommodate the expansion and home bedding of the KC-135 fleet. So to address the comment on lower ranks, yes, traditionally they would be single or have smaller families. It would be accommodated on base, but with the reduction of on-base housing, it is meaning that there's more lower ranks that are looking for off-base.
Well, the lower ranks without dependents are going to be in the barracks, not in on-base housing.
That's not the facts that Colonel Williamson and the military command told us.
If I may add, the ranks that we were asked to focus on to mobilize this housing corps are on page 5 of this analysis, E4s, E9s, and Officer 1s to Officer 4s. Because of what Al was stating, some of the lower ranks are going to need to have off-base housing because there is a commitment to move a lot of the current on-base housing off because they are having problems also with storage facilities for a lot of this equipment. In fact, a lot of the storage facilities in the private sector within Parabanks are being rented by the military as temporary areas for utilization.
So even lower enlisted without dependents need to be moved off base.
They are actively, and please do, we need to include Fort Wainwright and their personnel that are also looking for housing units within the community. They are actively leasing off-base housing, those ranks as well. So that's why I'm just predicating it from the standpoint that it's the information that we have received and that we need to be accommodating really with this initial housing units is that it's really not limited to the higher ranks, you know, the pilots and their families that are coming through, but it's predominantly the larger personnel, the support staff that's coming through where that requirement really is within the community. The benefit is off-base, it's broader families, broader, you know, larger components that are actually going to be off-base. There's broader economic development that's there for the community.
Well, are we looking at the type of military housing that's currently on-base? So typically it's multi-family, zero lot lines that are being built. Are we doing single-family homes here or mixed?
It has only been focused on multi-family complexes, and this is actually working in line with the way that the property tax exemption has been adopted within the Fairbanks North Star Borough, which requires a building to have 5-plus units. So it's also looking at the fact that there's inflation that has affected housing development and costs, ways of ultimately reducing that to be affordable within the rates that are currently in place. And we do want to get to your initial question, right, about the ranks that can't afford this. But it is multifamily, it's reducing the lot lines. There is no single family development that's part of the 35 plus acres that we're looking at. It's really a mix of complexes that would support one bedroom, two bedroom, predominantly two bedroom, three bedroom.
And keep in mind that you're limiting your investor class if you have it at 5 units or more.
Well, that is a requirement that we're working with that's been put in place by the Fairbanks North Star Borough.
Okay.
What mechanism do you have in place to make sure it's military? Not everybody in Fairbanks can come out and rent.
Well, I would like to address that question. We do have the answer for you about which current classes can currently, based upon our assumptions before that. Do you want us to follow through on that? That question? Well,
it's really, if you look at once you factor in the rentals, there's only the two officer level positions that can routinely afford the level of rent that would be needed based on current market conditions. And so that's why the housing allowance becomes even more critical in this economic review.
And we have asked across the board, what is the rank class that is going to be the majority here? And we have to have a broader breadth to accommodate them, but where is really the majority going to be? And it's the lower ranks.
Do you know the cost of the shelter building?
We've got several inputs to stress it between different cost assumptions, and we see
I'd like to see that.
Look, Chair, it's based upon our current
budgets at this point in time. We do not have actual costs or bids that are from contractors to say this is definitive. But this is our current assumptions on that cost based on initial feedback from contractors.
I would think you can get from the community up there, you know, the average cost for
what's a five-plex cost?
Yeah, square footage to build this and square, you know, many foot for water and sewer and all that stuff.
Well, this is besides the civil infrastructure. We're actually looking at, because we have the ability to be, you know, a lot more flexible with how we structure ADA's investment into this. It's looking at what the cost per foot is currently for the developers that are going to need to hold this as an investment. And so they're needing a, you know, an adequate rate of return as well as, you know.
No, I understand that. Yeah.
So what is the cost that we're looking at for, say, a five?
I would prefer that we recess if you want to have that conversation, because at this point in time, it's our only assessments, and I'm very cautious of specific numbers being discussed at this point in time, because they become then benchmarks, and they really are early assessments.
You've got to be very careful about an 04 or 05 and all that before
that. Well, I would agree. That was benchmark against what our assumptions are.
Yeah. So what do we got on the military?
So what I think is pertinent input is that, and looking at some of the other parties that have actually applied at this point in time for the property tax exemption to the Fairbanks North Star Borough, we do know that they have proposed certain, and this is what Morgan was referring to, is they have proposed certain square footage per unit and, you know, the assumed lease rates that would be attached with that. So that's part of the information, too, that we've been working with. In making our own assessments. But ultimately, what we have seen is that those parties are looking at providing discounts for military personnel, but they are broadly available to all residents within the North Star or within the North Star Borough. But again, driving military benefits through discounts or through the lease rates.
So what you're saying then, so by clear, we've talked about this before, that anybody can come on and rent the property. So we would be building an infrastructure for the community, regardless of the discount. The community then would have access to it.
Chair, we are limited by regulations and statutes that are required for housing. And I would like to defer, if I could, to the Department of Law to give some comments on that side of what our requirements are.
Well, I just send us all a memo on that. I don't want to get in the middle of all that. But as I've mentioned before, that's a problem. You know, that now we're competing against the private industry completely and not trying to help a subset of the community that has a base housing problem, has a housing problem for military personnel. But you're opening up ADA to, in my opinion, to doing developments all over the state regardless of what the ramifications are, and become a political whipping board, and that's a problem.
Chair, if I could give some bullet points to it that are related to what you just mentioned, is that our ability to undertake this development is solely under a military facility zone, so it would need to be associated with supporting the military. The other side of it is that we also know that they're taking broader development, and the applications that are coming through to the Fairbanks North Star Borough are, you know, they are looking at the same issues that we're looking at on economic feasibility to make their decisions ultimately for development. So what we have focused on with this initial target, right, of putting in place 150 units, we've been really benchmarking between 144 to 155, I think it's been the level for the development on the land we have. If we're able to, through the structure, lower the cost barriers that are there and bring in multiple housing contractors through a common design, and they're willing to, you know, we can commonly, through the process, order all the goods, you know, the building materials that are required based upon 155 units versus ordering those components for an 8-plex or maybe 15 units. There are cost benefits broadly that come here and then start achieving some lower
rental rate, not within the bond that's currently available, and that needs to be adjusted, but able to get lower overall costs for these lease rates that will accommodate the military.
Well, the whole idea is to accommodate the military. The whole idea is that the people come up and the military has the confidence that their people have a place to stay, not the general rank and file of the Fairbanks community. So if it's opened up to everybody, regardless of the pricing, it's open up to everybody, that doesn't solve the initial problem. The initial problem is that the military needs a place to stay. And they think they don't have it. I'm not here to argue that point or not. But at the end of the day, that's the whole concept. It's for the military. Not for the entire community. If it's for the entire community, that's a whole different subset of information, Alan. And my whole, and I'll on the record, I'll say my whole support for this was the fact that the military, as Senator Sullivan said to me on the phone multiple times, the military will not bring people up if they don't have a specific place for them to stay. That's what we're trying to solve. So if it's for the general public and they take up 20% or 25% of the available 140 units, that means that 20 to 40 units are not going to the military, and that presents a problem to the command and to what we're trying to accomplish here, to grow the presence and support those two F-35 squadrons and the tankers. Pretty simple to me. If we physically can't do it because of statutes or regulations, okay, it is what it is. So we move on.
If I can
change
the 25%, which is the representation of the military community in Fairbanks, that actually represents 100% of the population expansion. So 25% of the population, but it's been 100% of, literally 100% of people coming into the community. So that's where 100% of the 99.9% of the housing needs are being generated from.
Again, we're going in at lower rates than the public, the general rate of return that a developer do. We're now competing the private industry on a general level in the Fairbanks community. Julie?
From my perspective, I didn't go into this supporting the project just for one subset of the population. My interest was a little broader in that I've been very vocal about the fact that I think that there's a housing problem statewide. I have yet to have one municipality approach me as the Commissioner of Commerce and say, we are flush on housing, we're doing good, we don't need anything. So every time we start the workforce conversation, we end up in this spiral of a housing problem. The interesting thing for me is I understand the mission of ADA, I understand the mission of AHSC, but my question is, if everybody stands back and says, we don't do that or we've not done that before, we still end up in this death spiral. I am very interested in this project from the perspective of really the numbers, and then also let's just say we start with this project is wildly successful, and you do it for the six communities that have military populations and projects and can ensure that there's a need for the housing. Well, that's still six communities that you've benefited across the state, essentially, using this model. But my secondary question would be, then we've produced data that could potentially help us to use this statewide. And I know that's going to send the chair into a fit, and that's not my intention at all.
Government is competing with private industry.
But if private industry isn't, the government is here to serve where private industry won't, and if every community in the state is saying they have a shortage of housing, and private industry has yet to step up.
There's no rate of return, Julie.
I understand that. But perhaps through public-private partnerships, there's some room for conversation about how we help. We can't just stand back if we're not going to do anything.
Well, I don't disagree with that, but this is for Ilsa.
Right.
And the Air Force, and it's a problem that's a big problem. And solving, to me, bringing in whatever percentage I'm fully capable of looking at every project standalone as I understand what it's all about and who the end users are and who we're trying to help and if they need help. But this is to help the military in Fairbanks. And that's the challenge. You bring other people into it, you're not helping them, but it's a challenge. So again, at the end of the day, I'm looking at this one. I'm not saying that there's other models. You can't take this and modify it to other places. I'm focused on right now on Fairbanks, North Pole, for the military, to help them, for their airmen, that the airmen can bring their families up instead of being up by themselves, their families someplace else, and then bringing them up 1 year at a time. That's not right. That's not right. So if the cost is doing it, ADA can bring tools to bring the cost down and infrastructure, great, for the military.
But not for the private sector.
We understand here. Chair, we understand the comments. We obviously are not proposing the investment at this point in time. We are looking at continuing our due diligence, the way we're working, putting pieces together. And we do take this and understand the issue that we'll need to address when we do present it, and we are proposing and hopefully being able to be prepared to propose this August 3rd.
To Julie's comment. Again, the community has to be behind it, first of all, right? And what that means is that, you know, ADA facilitates. I don't want to be known as coming in and competing. I want to facilitate. The community needs something, and it makes sense, and ADA has the tools to do it. I'm fully up to speed of looking at it from a perspective. The community needs this, but what I don't want to do is I do not want to get out there that ADA is now running around, especially in the Valley, saying that we're now competing with the private industry and bringing that, I guess, that criticism on this organization when it isn't due, because we're not doing that. And if you think about that, you know, when you think about the population basis, you've got Fairbanks, Anchorage, and the Valley, you're 600,000 people, all of which have grown up on the private side, except for certain, what I would call, instances from the military. And that doesn't mean that that's Delta Junction, Sitka, Juneau, Ketchikan, Kodiak. Those are all standalone communities that have their own needs and requirements that I would certainly consider looking at. But Fairbanks, you know, is a big enough community that to me, we're trying to help the military out there right now. And how we do that without getting the criticism that we're competing in the private sector is a tightrope.
I would like to generally say, right, because of the issue of competing, is that the way that it's been proposed and approached is to only focus on the land development and make every opportunity available to any interested home builder contractor to benefit from what we're doing. We're not looking to do it for only one developer. It's broadly on that. Chair, your comments were identified very early on with the way that it was proposed, that we're not looking to put ADA in a position to compete with any private contractor. If they're really going forward and able to go forward in the community and do their investment and now on their land development with their carbon tax exemption, that is a rising tide that lifts all ships. We want to ensure that the goal, the objective of the initial proposal, as Chair, as you all know, is to ensure that there's a level of housing that gets started.
And one more thing, we take Arizona from the Bankers Association. The local Alaska banks make a lot of return on development, construction loans, purchasing, developer has a piece of land, they finance the infrastructure, what we're doing up in the water sewer and the sewer, and then the building contractors come in and buy the lots, and then some of those same banks finance the lots. But typically, which I've done a lot in Anchorage, is that a developer has a piece of property, he develops it, he gets a construction loan from a bank, like a Northrop, especially, who specializes in that, for the water, sewer, storm, water, paving the curbs and all that, and there's a takeout price per lot, and then that's how they make their money. We can't compete against that. We cannot, in the what I call the general sense of Alaska, compete against that. We will take a lot of arrows from the banking side because of that. So we have to be very, very careful. That's why I'm so upbeat on this particular program. It's to the military. The community has had ample time to try to figure it out. They haven't done it. And if we have the tools to bear to help it, great. We may find out that it still doesn't work. But at the end of the day, we're trying to facilitate, not get into the development business. That's my concern. And how we structure it, how we present it to each community is really important. Otherwise, we'll end up with a lot of criticism, which I don't think we deserve because we're trying to help.
First of all, I want to thank Alan and Morgan staff for this because I think this is another great example where Ada will be creative outside of the box thinking to try to solve or help or benefit Alaskans. I think it happens all the time. I don't think it gets called out often enough, and I think you guys do take arrows. And I also feel like sometimes those arrows are shot from folks that also aren't necessarily going to pony up to the table and help solve the problem, right? So where I'm looking at this from the 40,000-foot level is if we don't have workforce, we're not helping to benefit the economy. If the workforce shortage is in part due to a housing shortage, I think Ada is the perfect organization to at least, like you said, help facilitate the conversation, and that's all I'm interested in doing at this point. So I really appreciate your guys' work on this. Thank you.
Thank you.
Look forward to it. Help the dogs.
Chair, we are pulling together the pieces. We're being helped by a lot of people. I really want to identify that, too, that within the Fairbanks North Star Rural community, you've heard from Mayor Ward, Brittany within his office have been helping us on every stage with the whole element of transferring it to the military facility zone, the land we're looking at. Mayor Welch and his team on the acquisition of the land, the Fairbanks Economic Development Corporation. We're helped by a lot of
people. Board Member Bill.
And that board member Bill. He has been more than he wants involved in the day-to-day discussions that are going on, but we have fully benefited from that.
Okay. That's everybody.
Yeah.
Great lunch. All right,
12:30.
What? Yeah.
Chair, you are on the record.
Thank you. Call the meeting back to order here after a brief lunch. I guess next is the Ambler Access Trail up on the list.
Yes, Chair, it's the update for the Ambler Access Project, and I would ask that Jeff and Juan please join me at the table to be available to provide some information and answer some questions.
Good afternoon.
So again, this is Alan Weiser, Executive Director for ADA. What we are looking to do is give an update to the board at this current time on what is the status for the project development. What we included in the packet and made available also for the public's review was the judgment that came through from Judge Gleason with the District Court of Alaska on the Department of Interior's voluntary remand request. So in summary, what I would provide, and people can certainly read within the motion itself or the decision itself, is that the court has accepted the request from the Department of Interior to voluntarily remand the record of decision. They've taken the court has taken the decision to not vacate the record of decision itself. So that means that the record decision stays in place, the environmental impact statement. However, there is additional work that's going to be required by the Department of Interior, really through the Bureau of Land Management, to administer on specifically the two issues that were raised by the Department of Interior and Bureau of Land, specifically the Department of Interior in their request, which is related specifically to caribou vegetation issues under ANILCA Section 810, and then under the cultural resources with Section 106, the tribal consultation, which was required prior to signing the programmatic agreement between the interested parties and the Bureau of Land Management, that we need to engage on, or Bureau of Land Management needs to engage on further tribal consultation. It remains unclear what the status is ultimately of the programmatic agreement itself with the ruling that's taking place. What she has, Judge Gleason in this case, has also decided is that it stays within the purview of the court, the District Court of Alaska, which we see as a positive in this case. And all parties are available to requisition reviews by the judge on actions that are currently taking place. And there's a requirement for the Bureau of Land Management, Department of Interior, to report on the status of the remand every 60 days. And we also see that as a positive, that was part of our petition request, that there is attached some level of accountability in the process that this is undergoing with the remand in place. What I would like to identify for the board and the members is that I have sent a letter to Deputy Secretary, or Deputy Secretary Tommy Boudreau, which was, currently looking for the specific letter that I sent. Sorry, one moment, please. Looking for. I had printed out a copy of it myself, and I know I have it on some papers here. I'm just looking for it. Sorry, not able to immediately locate it. But this was a couple weeks ago, ultimately sending to Deputy Secretary Tom Boudreau to identify and request that they start taking action in anticipation of a positive request on their side for the voluntary remand, and really asking that you start putting in place the process to address this as quickly as possible, because in our case, what we've identified is that there is a distinct need, that there's immediate action that takes place, that we are harmed with further delay that is occurring with the actions under the record of decision as it stays in place, and given the fact that this was a robust environmental impact statement implemented by the Bureau of Land Management, that these issues for remand can be quickly addressed and should be quickly addressed, clearly with the management going forward by the Bureau of Land Management, and we want to understand how they're going to be undertaking that. And I don't want to thank Remy very much. She's identified this a letter that's dated May 10th, 2022, to Deputy Secretary Tommy Boudreau. So I believe that must have been on the copier, and I apologize. So thank you very much, Stephanie, for providing this tonight.
Good to see you, Alan.
So that certainly occurs. I apologize. And I'll make a copy of this letter available. It is a public letter. It's really us trying to identify actions that they can take place now, actually leading up to the decision, and the decision had occurred actually last week, to really initiate this process. So also at this time, what I want to identify is the fact that the annual work plan, say the 2022 field season, which is related to the annual work plan, that this board approved a collective $30 million budget, and that's shared between ourselves and Amber Metals, actually total amount of $30.8 million at our January board meeting, and that's under resolution G2203. Now, subject to that, the executive director is able to make non-material modifications to what was proposed under that and approved by the board under that budget. We have made a few non-material, in my view, non-material adjustments to that budget, but it has kept it at the $30.8 million level. So we've brought in work that would have been done in 2023 and have moved some work out of the 2022 field season. And we have supplemented additionally stakeholder engagement funding by another $500,000 because of the requirements and to ultimately support what we saw as coming with the remand. So what has been fundamentally moved at this point in time, or I say deferred to later in the season, is some of the geotechnical work. However, we're approaching the current situation, understanding the decision that's been implemented by Judge Gleason of the District Court of Alaska and the obligations that the Bureau of Land Management has now with the remand, that this can coexist with the existing field season work that we have proposed. And what I want to identify the fact is that the work we are proposing is not what is being identified or is being pointed to as occurring on state, private, federal lands. It is final feasibility work. We are not constructing a gravel road at this point in time. We are continuing to do cultural resource work. We're doing hydrology studies. We do have within the annual work plan some geotechnical studies on locations that have already been, have full cultural resource reviews that are, we're still waiting for final information coming through from the BLM on those reports. We're talking about logistics work, setting up field camps that are necessary to undertake the additional cultural resource work that we're looking to do. So to identify this work that we're trying to do up this field season in the area of the route as ground-disturbing activities is not correct. It is continued final feasibility work. Under the programmatic agreement, which is signed between ourselves as a signature party with the Bureau of Land Management and other consulting parties, I do want to identify that the fact that the state has not ceded its rights to determine what occurs on state land to the federal government through the programmatic agreement. Neither has the Northwest Arctic Borough as a signatory to that agreement. Private landowners of Nana and Doyon are not signatories to the programmatic agreement. So the programmatic agreement itself relates to the phases of the project development, and it is specifically focused on construction activities. It is being applied in this case to final feasibility pre-construction activities, which is not normally the case in pursuing or agreeing to programmatic agreements, the application with the BLM. So, in our view, again, with scientific studies that are coming in place, that there is support to continue with the field season. There are reasons to continue with the cultural resource work that we've identified with the other field study work, hydrology work, understanding at this point in time, the icebergs that will impact some of the bridges that are being proposed, that this is critical at this stage and should not be delayed. Otherwise, it is continued looking at incorrectly and unjustifiably delaying the project from our investment potential and the economic development benefits that were promised to the state through ANILCA, the initial reason codified access of this project. So stating that, what I would ask is, Jeff, can you give a brief information for the board on what our current activities are, particularly on the hydrology side,
yeah,
and what we are currently planning on date-wise for field crew activity, and then please give a brief discussion at this point in time on where we are with our permitting.
Okay. So currently we are undergoing overflight reports on the ice breakup for the different river crossings, and so there are concluding that this week. They've been taking notes every day for the past 10 days or so, making notes as to how the ice flows or if there's any ice jamming, so that where they put their bridges may have an effect on it. So that's currently underway right now. So those are helicopters flying out of Coldfoot pretty much every day. And then from a field activity standpoint, the project is planning on starting all of the additional items that Alan mentioned about hydrology. The first thing we're going to be doing is only conducting activity where we have permits in place. So they kind of go hand in hand. So we've secured our start date was June 1st for the project. So we're planning June 1st for all activities that are low, limited, ground-disturbing activities, so there's no geotechnical investigations happening in the next, I don't know, 9 days or so until we get approval from BLM. And then also what we're planning on doing is when we get permits in hand, which right now the only permits we have in place is with DOYON. So DOYON has given us authorization to conduct all the activities that we presented in our draft annual work plan at BLM, which includes landing zone clearing. So the first order of items is Ada going out with a biologist and also only clearing sites that have been inventoried for cultural resources. So we want to make sure that we're protecting any cultural resource artifacts from being disturbed. So that's number one. And then following will be all of the other crews once we get some safety zones, land zone, site preparations cleared, and then moving forward with hydrology studies, reconnaissance for engineering reconnaissance so that the engineers can have boots on the ground to see where the potential bridge crosses could be. We have topographic surveyors going out in the field, basically finding landmarks. And then later on in the field season, we'll be having fish habitat studies as well as wetland delineation towards the later part of July. So that's currently what we have in place. As I stated, we only have one permit in hand right now, that is DOYON, but we are anticipating permits from the state of Alaska, June 1st. We're also anticipating permits from NANA by June 1st as well, and then we'll have the remaining permits in hand by middle of June 4th for the Northwest Iowa Borough side for the coastal resources.
If I could get some background information on the fact that we have had permitting in process with as early as later part of March, early part of April. With the state, they had to go through a public review process, and we have been assured that we'll be receiving those permits when we need to by June 1st, so we're comfortable with that. To address the element with NANA, we do have an adjustment in the annual fee related to very specific work that is going to be occurring and has been proposed at this point identified for NANA. So that is one of the non-material modifications on the budget that I will be exercising and signing that permit, that amendment to the permit with NANA. So we'll have that in place by tomorrow.
Price went up.
They're asking for additional $19,000 to cover the specific work that was not identified earlier in the other permit.
How many miles of road is on their land?
A little over 26 total.
Are you comfortable with DNR finally on June
1? I am comfortable with that, yes.
If for some reason that doesn't happen, what does that do economically to the spend?
I don't know if we've exactly quantified the initial mobilization cost, because that's what it really addresses. We're working with Amber Metals on establishing Doll Creek Camp, which in large part is supporting the cultural resource work that's going to be occurring in Northwest Arctic Borough area.
The reason why I asked was I would suggest that you let them know what the economic consequences if they miss that milestone again.
Sure, we will.
The permitting that we're talking about isn't with DNR, it's with ADFE, right?
That's one element. That's one side of the permitting, just in case. But there is, with Division Mine of DMLW, we're looking for land use permits that are coming from DNR. Yes, we do.
I just think in the future, this is a suggestion, that when you go to a sister agency, that you put the economic consequence based on, they give you a schedule, if they miss it, what the economic consequence is to the whatever projects we're doing at the time. So they at least understand. They may not make the milestone, but at least they have something to say, hey, we understand what it would cost to delay, including, in this case, a joint venture partner, which is part of the cost.
And I communicate that with Commissioner Feige, she's absolutely on this, and I know her staff have been as well, my understanding, but I appreciate that.
We have
currently policy things.
Chair, I think you make a very good point, and we will undertake that. And the one thing I would identify is we've been principally working through under DNR, they have the old pump, the Office of the Project Management and Permitting, So it is Kyle Mazzell who leads that group, and he's been directly involved with us. Kate Harper has been directly on that. And, you know, from everything that we've seen, there has been a lot of attention to this particular issue.
So, when do you think peak work will be hitting?
Again, we're focusing on June 1st, mobilizing.
To build up, there's going to be a peak. When do you think that'll be?
I would say middle of July is when we'll have a lot of crews in the field, because that's when we're all for having, if we we'll have cultural resources, we'll have all of the fish habitat folks as well as wetland delineation in the ground. So we're up to 50 people potentially on this. Actually, I would say 40 people.
So you're going to have people at Salt Creek?
Correct.
And where?
So the first part of the project is focused on the western side, I mean eastern side, at Coldfoot, because the only permit we have in place right now is Dora. So all activity that we can get done on Dora land is our first objective. And then towards June 20th is when we're transitioning, when the camp is going to be available. And all of our crews will be moving to towards the later end of June on the western side.
All right, so you couldn't come to terms with anybody in Vettles? So Coldfoot adds cost to them because of the distances, especially if you look on the right. When do you think it would be a good time, the reason why I asked about peak, for the rest of this board to be able to see the mine and what we're doing out there? You know, we're spending a lot of money, public money. Who on this board has never seen the Amber Mine, the Doll Creek? What's going on?
Okay.
So I think we should put together a program so that we all can go out there and look at, you know, wherever we would stop, obviously, with its proper, you know, hopefully with helicopters, there's other places besides Doll Creek we can look at, but to get a tour of the Amber Mine, what you're doing out there, the board gets a feel for what we're spending money on, and maybe a little overview at the Doll Creek facility. I think it's really important that I spent a whole summer up there back in the day when I was a young kid, so in college, and I've been up there many times hunting and flew with the helicopter a little bit. So I would really like the board to see what they're looking at, what they're spending money on, what the ultimate goal is, and why.
But Jerry, you and I had an opportunity. So, Jerry, you and I had the opportunity to be out there last year, towards the end of the last year's field season. So, I think what you're raising is definitely essential, right, for the rest of the board to have a chance to see the environment that we're dealing with and what's being proposed. I would need to coordinate with Amber Metals and Nana as the landowner to arrange all that, but we'll undertake that and see what time it could be put in place. We'll propose some dates to you.
So having more than three board members there, is that constitute a meeting?
Yes, it does.
We notice that, so we're going to have a work session then.
Yeah.
Someplace.
Well,
Ramsey for
10. We'll need to coordinate with some external parties to define that, so I will need to come back to you with recommendations on certain dates, and then once we get that confirmed, we'll issue a public notice.
What about funding?
Okay. Yeah.
Sheriff?
Yes.
Sheriff, what about funding for that?
Comes out of the project.
Thank you.
The $30 million.
So if I can also address, through the chair, board member Fogle, you raised an element with the advisory committee. So we have established a citizens advisory committee, and that's with direct engagement with Nana, with Doyon, with input coming from Amber Metals, with input coming from our co-chairs that were ultimately named, being Fred Beifelt and Larry Westlake. So there was the citizens advisory committee. The next meeting is going to be on June 26th through 28th, I believe, or 27th through the 29th, and it's going to be up in Kotzebue. And part of that meeting is actually taking the members of this Assistant Advisory Committee, part of that through the co-chairs and the policies and procedures that were set up for were ultimately identified, nominated by the different villages, and then identified for participation on the committee, that they would take a tour of the Red Dog facilities. And that was actually proposed by the group that we're working with, who's been actively involved in coordinating information with NANA, presented that to us and identified that really to our co-chairs, and they want to pursue this, and that's been arranged. And I think that is a extremely important addition to what that Assistance Committee is going to see. They're going to see a mine that's in operation, get a view ultimately of what a road operation is attached with that, what it really consists of, how, in this case, the Assistance Advisory Committee that's attached with the Red Dog development operates within NANA, and then address the issues that are coming up ultimately at this point with the Amber Access Project. Now, what I would like to inform the board, and I'm not sure if you're particularly aware, is that we have attempted to engage again with NANA Chiefs Conference to see how they can be participating on this assistance committee, providing input. The obligation that we have under the programmatic agreement and under the record of decision really is focused on, again, it's the issues of, it's focused on construction. We are in pre-construction phase, our final feasibility phase, but ADA did undertake an unusual role in this case, and it has not been done before in project development within Alaska, but that is not being broadly identified in the discussion about this committee, is that we took an early step in forming this committee prior to the requirements that are in the record decision and the programmatic agreement because of the importance of the issue and knowing that we have input that's coming through as their advice of how we're progressing ultimately on the status of the project and where we're at on incremental design. The requirement within the record of decision itself is really at a 90% design side, and we're very far from that position at this point. We're in this current field season, we're looking at getting to 35% design. So it's an unusual step that we took. We formed the committee. They have active participation from the villages. However, we have received letters from Chief Ridley with Canada Chiefs Conference, making certain requirements from their side on the way that we are, ADA is required to engage with TCC. So we asked the SAC, the Assistance Advisory Committee, the co-chairs, to delay a meeting that was scheduled in April so we could engage with TCC. We went through that process, and we went back and forth on trying to arrange certain dates. We had defined a certain date in May that we can engage directly with TCC, but we needed to have the parties that we work with in the formation of the committee, which is NANA, Doyon, Amber Metals, the Sustainability Advisory Committee co-chairs. This is not ADA's committee. It is the co-chairs committee. They ultimately declined to have that meeting. They were requiring it to be specifically with ADA and with lawyers. And that is not the purpose of the Assistance Advisory Committee. It is a technical committee. So we are going forward with having that meeting, and that's why I really want to identify everyone that has been scheduled for the early part of that week in June, last week in June, so starting on the 27th through the 29th. I will be participating in Kotzebue on the 27th to 28th. We do have our board meeting that is currently scheduled for the 29th. But that is the current status with the committee itself, just, again, addressing from the comment that was raised.
Well, we could add to the board, because there's people that probably haven't seen that either. It's a long day. Go directly from here to the Ambler site. And then go from, not then, whenever. And then go from there for a few hours to Red Dog. You see that too. It'll be a long day, but get a lot in. Plenty of daylight. Do you see what a new mine will look like and an old mine? The only one that's been there. How many of you haven't seen Red Dog? Yeah.
Okay. We will look to undertake that. That is an additional component we need to engage with Tech and NANA on the operations side for being having access to the mine development. And they operate the road. Well, they operate the terminal, and it's part of our agreement that we make arrangements that they're notified ahead of time.
No, the bankers show up. Is this one like the bankers?
If there are no other questions on Ambler Access Project,
I want Ambler Metal Spill, everything good with them?
At this stage, yes. We have been working together on everything with scheduling for the what is planned on the annual work plan, what is currently looking at on the furnace. We have weekly meetings that are updating that information, and that's all under our development agreement with them.
Okay.
So with the update on West Sitna Access Project, I would like to ask if Jesse Peterson would join me. He's the project manager for the development. What I would like to identify to the board is that ADA has submitted its application for a 404 permit to the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. We did that yesterday. It was submitted. We also issued a press release at that point in time to really notify for the public that we have undertaken that application. And there is also a opinion piece that we have submitted to different newspapers that's ultimately supporting why we have undertaken the application at this stage. The comments, public comments, I do want to recognize again from Melissa Hewer, the executive director of the Sitna River Coalition. What she was identifying. Excuse me?
Send the board a copy of the opinion piece before this opinion.
I'm happy to provide it to the board. The comments that are coming from about the economic study, I do want to identify the fact that there is a independent study that has been put in place or facilitated through the governor's office in assessing the economic impact and benefits that are coming from the road development. That is separate from what ADA itself is continuing to undertake in our economic analysis that's related to the project. So that's running concurrently and that's what we're following up on. Ultimately, if we give a little bit of information on the application submission and just where we stand at this point in time for the benefit of the board, please.
Certainly. So yesterday was a big milestone for the West Sitna project with us submitting the permit application to the Corps. So it's in their court right now, and they're going to let their process run. I anticipate this will be about a 12 to 18 month process. We are gearing up to start our field season. There's going to be some more engineering refinements. We're going to have cultural surveys. Part of the 404 permit, there's also a parallel track that runs with the 106. Which is the cultural and historical aspect side of project development. And so we're gearing up to start that. We've engaged with SHPO, and we're going to figure out our plan for the season and starting some of the initial engagements with the local tribes as well. So the field work that will begin, it'll be the cultural and historical studies at some of the different sites. There will be some stream crossing refinements, bridge refinements, culvert refinement, and we've engaged with Fish and Game on how we're doing that. And then also there's going to be some alternative route identification and further refinement of those alternatives. And like I said, this is really in the Corps, Army Corps of Engineers court right now, and this will be their process that they drive, and we'll be responsive to any questions that they have and help facilitate the process. So.
Chair, for the board's benefit, what I would like to identify too is the fact that this is a road project that has been identified as early as 2013, 2014 it has a resolution that was passed by the Mattsu Borough Assembly back in 2014 when it was part of the Road to Resources Project planning. Also, it reminds the board that Ambler Access Project was one of the principal and first road to resource that was identified. This was the second, was this an access road? So the economic study, the resources have been addressed and identified since that initial planning that was undertaken by the Department of Transportation. And to remind everyone, back in 2019 is when ADA took this over in partnership with the Mattsu Borough. That's when we entered into and achieved the board's approval for a memorandum of understanding directly with the Mattsu Borough to initiate the first phase, which was really some of the early pre-feasibility work on the road development on route, which resulted in full focus on what has been now submitted to the Corps, which is the route going from Fort McKenzie through road network, ultimately accessing a point at HR Road, going from into West Susitna area, ultimately leading to across the Susquehanna into the Yetna Mining District area. So it was reviewed at that point in time. Secondarily, in 2020 and in 2021, resolutions were approved by the Mattsu Borough in support of these phases. The last one I'm referring to in 2021 was in support of this phase in accepting $8.5 million that was defined by the legislature for this road development, which is ultimately what ADA is pursuing at this point in time. So when it's raised, why do we take this action at this point? Why did we, ADA, initiate an application to the Corps for the road permitting? It was defined for us to do this by the legislature in an allocation of $8.5 million. And so we are pursuing what we've been directed in that point. We are following up on what has been approved by ADA's board and by the Mattsu Borough Assembly in pursuing this application. It starts the entire public engagement process from the Corps' review side, again, assuming that they are going to take the application and start initiating the 404 permit process.
Okay, so I'm going to ask for the board's indulgence here for 15 minutes. I would like to go in the executive session for 15 minutes to discuss the Western Access.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to motion that we go into executive session to discuss West Susitna Access Road.
This is discussing the road. Your second?
I second.
Department of Law approves the motion to enter into closed executive session to discuss only confidential or privileged matters. Department of Law will remain present throughout the entirety of the executive session to ensure that only confidential or privileged matters are discussed.
All right. Is there any objection? All right. With that, we're going to go into executive session. Let's see. Attorneys, Alan, our project manager, you can say again, just for the face of West Susitna.
Jay, you're on the record.
Thank you, and welcome back. We are going out of executive session. I'll state that the board is taking no action on West Susitna.
Thank you, Chair. The Department of Law confirms that the executive session is now complete. The project confirms that the only matters discussed were confidential and privileged nature. No further actions were taken by the board.
Wendy, would you please, for the record, give your name and position, please?
Yes, Wendy Morton, Assistant Attorney General, Department of Law.
Thank you, Wendy. So does that mean we're going out to Julie's favorite project, Alaska Ship and Dry Dock, that money-making facility down there for April?
We have an update for the Alaska Ship and Dry Dock, and again, I would ask that the project manager, Jesse Peterson, join me at the table to address any questions. We do have some information. Brandy, do we have the fact sheet that was available? So we would like to draw the board's attention and the public, this was linked ultimately on the agenda for this. There's a fact sheet that was prepared that is an update of my own activities over with the Alaska ship and dry dock. Jesse, if you could please give you a summary, just identify the last resolution where the adjustments were made ultimately on the remediation plan, and give an update, please, for the board on where that stands.
Right, so in November 2020, Board Resolution 20-28, ADA and Vigor agreed to increase Vigor's obligation to our account by $50,000 in recognition of the increased maintenance cost at the yard. And so part of that agreement was also a chance to aggregate the total maintenance costs from 2018 through 2022 for review in Q1 of 2023 with the purpose of having a better understanding of what annual maintenance costs should be at the Ketchikan shipyard. And so that's going well, and Bergen and I have a good working relationship, and we're in touch and have quarterly updates on our maintenance every quarter. So the resolution is working well, and I expect next year that we'll have some good accurate data to fall back on.
So, Chair, to the Board, are there any specific questions that we can address at this stage on any inquiries you have on current status and operations at the shipyard?
I have one. What's the deferred maintenance number?
Oh, on the deferred. Go ahead.
So the deferred maintenance, that was obviously, it grows every year, but we're somewhere in the $3 to $5 million range right now with some of the larger deferred maintenance issues.
At some point in time, we get that list with a budgetary number before.
Certainly.
And then maybe it has to do by dates or something, like if it's not done, or something that says if this maintenance particular item on the list isn't done by a certain time, we may lose, you know, just part of the asset or.
Yeah. Yeah. We do that.
Have you heard, or does the board want to have any sort of, or does the board need to have any sort of a summary or a response from Vigor about the vote to be unionized and how that may impact their operations? Is that something that we should be operator about?
Through the chair, board member Sandy, we discussed with Vigor specifically, asked him back about that update. He said we would have a more comprehensive call around what that would mean after the vote. As he put it, he remains cautiously optimistic that it continues to go in Vigor's favor, and that the vote does not succeed on unionizing.
Okay,
that's all we have to convey at this point.
What's the functional life left of the facility?
I mean, it depends on, we look at it on our book value, we still have it.
No. So functional life, that's not a book value. Functional life is, if you don't do any deferred maintenance, how long will it last?
Well, it depends on which section you're talking about.
That's
right. Well, okay, give me percentages. This section's got 5 years, this one's got 10 years.
The most immediate, which one's the part that if we don't immediately, that's the one that's eroding what section?
Yeah, so there's a couple, I guess, areas of concern that I would highlight. One of them is the receiving dock that, the receiving slab, sorry, that receives the ships when they come off the dry dock. I actually believe all the settlement has been taken out, and they're continuing to monitor that, but it is limited in its capacity on the size of the ships that it can handle. So that would be an area that we need to address. You'll see the pier there with the ship docks. I think some of the piles need to be looked at. There needs to be a cathodic protection taken into account to keep those from eroding away. I know that Bergen and I have started replacing some of the the pier stations for the shift-to-shore power. There's I think there's 13 of them, and we've started replacing those. We're going to do one a year as part of our major maintenance plan. You know, the R&R account doesn't have the funds to support a massive deferred maintenance program, but we can kind of check the box on some of these smaller items on an annual basis. So we're continuing looking to upgrade those. You know, and then the dry docks, basically those are floating steel bathtubs in salt water, and those need to be taken care of. You know, and there's coatings is a constant. Redoing the coatings and sandblasting and painting, and much like what we did with dry dock number one with this ram coat, that needs to be something that we can really focus on in order to keep the yard in good shape.
Well, and Jesse is just a miraculous job in my mind and working with Bergen, who, you know, I also really appreciate Bergen's efforts, both of their communication style, but I have found to be really uplifting, to be perfectly honest, even on the things that you may not immediately agree on. So this, especially this coming to an agreement on shared language and usage and definitions, it's helping with being able to code things to the account in a way that everybody agrees upon. So that gives us the ability then to add a piling or whatever a year, you know, so we can start to check some things off of the box. But in answer to Dana's question, I mean, I didn't realize until, I mean, I'm embarrassed to say that as a community member, but I didn't realize until I got on this board in terms of facility that Alaska has a state-of-the-art resource located in Ketchikan with this yard. So, yes, the deferred and major capital projects are worrisome, but there's a lot of that yard there that's in really great shape and something to be really proud of. Granted, there's some...
Is the facility being depreciated on the books?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Can someone tell me how much a year I can go back and give you? Because there's been obviously reinvestment, but I can tell you approximately what the book value is today. But I give you the accumulated depreciation.
So that,
I have it over here.
So that depreciation is a non-cash item, right?
That's right.
So in reality, if we did a capital improvement project on that, we could use that. It wouldn't be a financial loss on our balance sheet. All it would be doing is taking that depreciation and applying it to a cash item. But it would be, so it would not hurt our P&L statement. It would not hurt our profits.
No, because if it's a CapEx, it's going in as your asset item.
And you're recapitalizing it.
That's correct.
So when you go and you do, when I see this deferred maintenance and I see what the depreciation is, we may start taking that money and putting it aside. It's because it's, even though we don't pay taxes, but it's still effective. When we take that money and reserve it back around with maybe some more money from the state that we negotiate in order to get back up to speed on deferred maintenance. But I can't say if that makes sense until I see what the annual depreciation number is. But at some point in time, you're going to use the functional loss of the facility, maybe in parts, and then it becomes less and less, and then it becomes less, you know, more expensive. And, of course, the first thing is we know it's $1 today. In 10 years, that same replacement is $10. So, I mean, to do it, either keep deferring it, costs more and more to fix the original problem. But if we're taking depreciation on our books, spending those dollars, those depreciation dollars, and coming up with a capital program to reinvest back into the dry dock facility, doesn't affect our P&L statement or the dividend to the state.
And I think
is that an accurate statement?
That would be an accurate statement, although what I would want to identify to the board is that the capital contributions from ADA have been limited, and it's been defined that way with the operation and ownership of the project with benefit from state support that's been identified for the capital programs that have been initiated and federal funding. So we have not broadly dedicated ADA funding for this, and it does get to the relationship of how the project was established with a partnership with the Ketchikan Borough. So the focus has been on that R&R account being maintained and contributed by the borough and the community.
Well, a secondary piece to this is the strategic plan. We have to come up with a new, when I say we, I mean the borough. We're still waiting for a new I don't know if there was going to be a study, but it was a conversation that we participated in, Vigor, Alaska Shipping Fair, not Vigor, and the borough were going to be working on a strategic plan that would help us understand where we are with some of like the deferred or the major capital projects, because the last time it was done in 2012, there were needs then that they openly agree they no longer need or have shifted direction on. We're not looking to be a major manufacturer of large cruise ships in Alaska. We're really shifting focus to repair, and so maybe some of the large cranes or things that they had on the list they do not need anymore. So that is a part of our conversation, but it was going to be dependent on another, I hate to say that loud, but another study would need to be done or another strategic plan. And so some of the information that we as a board would need in order to make plans for funding, you know, or support and funding would be in part based on a strategic plan that's still in.
So I'm thinking ahead. What I'm trying to avoid here, I think we should try to avoid, is that at some point in time, Vigor will be up for renewal. And we're going to have a facility there, and we're going to help to attract people to come in and maybe be better, maybe not, maybe. But if we don't have a facility that's up to speed, the first thing, if I was going to come in and lease it, I would say, you've got to do tenant improvements on your own nickel.
Sure.
So my goal here is to not let that happen. My goal is somehow, wherever the money comes from, this remains to be seen, you know, but you do not want to go into a new term with any new operator or the same operator with a facility that has a lot of deferred maintenance. You want to be able to present the best thing for them so you get the best rate of return or whatever they're going to do for the facility and the community. And I think it's to the point now, how far are we away from renewing or?
Sure, this was going to identify as that, again, this is Alan Weiser, that the operating agreement that we have in place with Vigor Alaska as operator of the facility is through 2025. And that's also been related to the agreements that we have in place with the Gateway Borough and City and Municipality of Ketchikan. So it's a coordination, it's a public-private partnership involved on this. So if there were decisions that were being made on how to start addressing these issues, it would be at that point in time with the new operating agreement.
It would be now. You want to come up with it. You're 2 years away, almost. 2.5. You want to now put the program in place in order to have that facility so it's up to speed with whoever the person is.
What I'm identifying is that end point to the current agreement. You're talking about preparation leading to that point, and I would agree that that would need to occur.
What is on the balance sheet right now? What's the depreciated value to you?
The total depreciated value is 66.9 million. Sorry. At the end of the year, 64.1 million on our balance sheet.
Have you had it appraised?
No, we have not had the facility appraised.
I think it was on the record you offered to give it to me at one point.
Absolutely, with $5 million of the deferred maintenance. So it may be something that you want to do an analysis somehow on the value of it. I mean, again, in 2.5 years, either you're going to have the same person in there or someone new. It's good to know what it's worth. It's good to know what we have to do in order to get up to speed. It's good to know that when someone says, hey, I can lease it for a long term, but I need this added to it, that's a different capital question. Mm-hmm. But in reality, and we're already depreciating it, so somehow a combination to me, in order to be good stewards of this asset for the public, we need to start the process now.
Isn't there another piece to this, though, that we needed to be careful to watch the deadline of something related to
the Department of DOT?
Yes.
That's the South Korea.
That's the waking me up at night. I can't work. So talk to me. What's the deadline there?
It coincides with the lease expiration, right?
It's close. It's not.
If we don't take,
it coincides with it.
But if we don't take action on something, we relinquish it?
There's an arrangement that we have in place with the Department of Transportation where we have transferred or been able to have a lease on land,
mm-hmm.
provided we were financing and putting in place a new berth for them, which was intended in Ward Cove.
Mm-hmm.
During that time, they've been occupying South Berth. And so
at a cost of?
Well, it's under their own maintenance and under their own obligations. And for unfortunately, it appears that that maintenance has not been occurring. So it's the swap that occurred in that place, and it would come back to us.
Mm-hmm.
And the land that was leased to us that's currently under Department of Transportation was from them would go back to the Department of Transportation. That actually is part of the parking lot area that's being used by the facility and is also where the main hall portion of the main hall is currently built on. So there's a need to ensure that there is a continued availability of that land from the Department of Transportation. And it's also very clear that that berth would not be constructed or has not gone forward by the Department of Transportation or Ward Cove.
Mm-hmm.
So the maturity of that, and then we have to look at the specific dates, but I do think it's a few years out. I think it's 5 years out from now.
Yeah, I want to say 2027 is about, sounds about right.
So there is time to address this, but it is something that specifically does need to be addressed, does need to be incorporated into the operating agreement before that time period or with that time period in 2025, latest.
Yeah.
Well, again, I'm just trying to, from at least my perspective, we start doing it now, we'll save us in the end, and we'll be in charge of a good facility.
Is that something that Commissioner Anderson, you and I need to have a conversation about together?
It would be helpful. I've raised it with Commissioner Anderson. It would be helpful that we have a continued discussion on that because we do need to have an agreement of how that land will work, and I believe that they would need to continue to have access to that south berth in that case. So, okay. The other element that I want to raise is when we've been talking about the total book value that we have for the Ketchikan asset, the Alaska Ship and Dry Dock, that is compiled from the actual cost of investment that was put in by state initial, coming from the municipality and federal funds to build out the facility. The picture that we have that's in this fact sheet is not the shipyard itself as it actually is. This was the initial drawing that was put in place looking at all of the capital projects that were envisioned with the final investment plan for it that was put together in coordination with ADA, with Alaska Ship and Dry Dock at that point in time, with the state. So it's not, that reflects more facilities than are currently at the shipyard. There is an additional $50 million of investment that would fulfill the final capital plan that's ultimately for the project. That is another issue that needs to be addressed in any other party that's going past 2025 is what is the investment plan, what is the real capital plan that is needed for the Alaska Ship and Dry Dock, particularly given the strategy or the approach that operator would be taking with the shipyard.
So the current plan is not, it's outdated.
Well, again, you have a depreciated asset that was given by the legislature of the state, put on ADA's books as depreciating tax, so that we're not getting any money to cover the depreciation in the lease, and so there would be a draw on the ADA's financials to take the cash out, right? And since we don't pay taxes, depreciation is just a book thing. That's nothing to do with, government. You're not going to get a 35% benefit like private people do, right? So that's really the challenge by identifying what needs to be done and identifying to me, you go to the legislature, you say, hey, this thing's depreciating at a couple million dollars a year. If we don't put the money back in, if you don't put the money back in, ultimately there'll be nothing to lease in 2025 or be very little and it'll be it's the cost of owning something. In the previous meeting today, when you own something, even though you're letting someone use it for nothing, there's still a cost. And trying to cover that cost is the challenge.
Chair, I think we've had a few conversations on this over the years about the project itself. And I think we all have recognized the fact that the operating agreement, as originally structured, doesn't recognize those points. And we're working with the existing agreement, and that's why, again, I emphasize the maturity that comes to that agreement really is the point of how you redefine these critical issues. And it is in partnership with the city and the Gateway Borough
in part of what they're looking for.
Deferred maintenance that we have to do, and go say, hey, we need your support to go get a from the legislature to do this, and here's our schedule. And that's, you know, but we got to start somewhere.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
That's good conversation.
I appreciate how optimistic you are about the sugar and cash candidate, you know?
I want to be bigger, Commissioner.
I'm just kidding. You know that.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, she got more stroke, and look what happens.
Isn't that a who?
Okay, that brings us with the org charts, John. Sorry, sir, just got a name. I have some papers over here. So what we wanted to be able to identify is, you know, currently we've made a few changes that I do want to highlight or need to highlight for the board. One of the key areas is a new position that we defined, and that is the general counsel position. So this has been in discussion with Department of Law and with the governor's office, and really looking to conclude a memorandum of understanding that's between ourselves and Department of Law, how that is structured and put in place. But at this stage, we are looking to initiate the recruitment for a general counsel position. Now, this position would be reporting to, functionally reporting to the executive director of ADA. AR is working with both executive directors for AEA and with ADA, would be functionally an ADA employee. And it's, again, taking on the transactional legal responsibilities that are there for and needed, I say vastly needed, within AEA and ADA itself. There are critical elements that are state sovereign issues related to, you know, elements of some litigation, elements of opinions to be taken that are really in the purview of the Attorney General. We're recognizing that within the memorandum of understanding, but it is to functionally have someone that is reportable to the executive directors and to the board on a consistent basis. So also with the organization chart, what we're looking to identify for everyone is the fact that we do have a few positions that are currently in process. We have identified people that are for us that would be filling those. In large cases where we have elements that are gray, we have a position and a hire in process. These are particular positions where they have accepted the position, but we are going through the process that, unfortunately, I do need to identify has become a little complicated. Now, what I really want to, you know, element to really emphasize here is that we have very high quality staff. They do undertake a lot. These are employees directly that are for the state that have a focus and a delivery on our mission. They are joining us because of belief in that mission. And I think there's always going to be a role for our staff and expanding our staff on that basis. And we've been able and been very fortunate in identifying that kind of qualified, experienced staff. And in some cases, we're being delayed in ultimately retaining them. And I just want to identify that for you, too, is that in itself is a bit of a complication. We've been working with Commissioner Sandy and her office in ways that we can help together help expedite that process.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Randy.
Question for you, Alan. What services beyond what the Attorney General's and his staff is providing you currently will you have for this new position?
Through the chair, Board Member Ellich, what we were mostly focused on are transactional issues. And also want to highlight the program management of our external counsel. So it's a couple issues in our ability to access external counsel in cases where board has directed it or it's on the initiative of the executive director. We do functionally work through the Department of Law. They are the ones that have, through their procurement, engaged the external counsel. But a key difference in this case, Board Member Eldridge, is that we would have someone internally within ADA who has been hired by ADA, is accountable within ADA, that is actually managing those contracts and the engagement with them, ensuring that billing is accurate, that the funding and direction that is occurring with those external lawyers is also being managed internally by someone who is accountable within ADA and AEA. The elements of transactional, when I address commercial agreements, UCC filings, other things that ADA fundamentally undertakes in its process as a financial authority, other actions that AEA takes in their authority that are transactional can be directly undertaken by the General Counsel.
So we'll still have someone from the Attorney General's office in our meetings going forward, or do you think that this new position will take care of that as well?
I believe that this new position will be taking care of that because of the principal responsibilities they will have. It's within the description in the Memorandum of Understanding that there is a coordination aspect to the role of General Counsel with Department of Law. There may be some cases, Board Member Eldridge, where we would request Department of Law to be attending for specific issues.
And this will be a full-time position, correct?
Through the Chair, Board Member Eldridge, that is correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Alan.
Other questions on the... Eldridge and I have a couple.
Mr. Stedham, so I know the Permanent Fund Corporation has general counsel, and certainly if
railroad.
Yeah, and if it's warranted in that instance, the level of sophisticated transactions and business arrangements that are underway within ADA certainly warrant that same level of counsel.
Thank you, Devin. So, Alan, I'm just looking at the overall thing here, and this is not a loaded question. This is really a question about how to help you. So you have, I just counted up real quick, there's 83 rough positions identified on here.
Yep.
Counting the vacant communication director now, there are 19 or 20 vacancies, which translates to 23% of this org chart. The question I have is obviously some of these must be new, and what is that doing to you as far as executing a mission?
So, Chairman, what you're raising is an issue that all agencies, authorities within the state of Alaska, and what we also understand in talking with our private partners, they're having the same issue of really identifying qualified, experienced staff that comes through and is, in this case, accepting these positions. What has occurred for us, and I really want to identify this, is that we have had parties that have accepted positions with AEA and ADA that we have not been able to timely accept their acceptance of our position. And that is one of the issues of conflict that we're really working with Commissioner Sandy. She's been extremely proactive on how we can be more responsive internally as a state operation to obtain these staff positions. So there are parties that are very interested to be part of the state, be part of ADA, be part of AEA, and I would highlight it's because of our mission that they're looking to do that. There are complications in being able to actually bring them on board on time before they've accepted another position, because these are very qualified people.
So is there a ramification to executing a mission?
At this point in time, we are, as you well know, we are pushed to our limits in the work that we're asking our staff to undertake in fulfillment of our mission. I would like to qualify as too. You looked at the total PCNs. I know you're very well aware of this issue, but the public may not be well aware of this issue, is that on their organization chart you have effectively 27 positions that are specifically focused on ADA loan programs. So out of the 83, that's 27 professionals in a broad range of capacities that are undertaking eight
specific loan programs and administering and monitoring close to 18 projects.
So Alan, the way again, the percentages probably don't play out, but I kind of look at this and say that the people that you have here are working at least 20-some percent more than they should be because there's 23% less people than there should be.
I would say that percentage that they're not, that they're working was...
Some probably more.
...was more because already, and you may remember the information on this, but previously Ada had in excess of 100 QCMs. That was reduced at a point in time when the initial budget issues impacted the state.
We had a conversation earlier when the system was going and the number of people that Energy Authority had. I mean, there's a lot. It was very painful. I wasn't completely up to speed on when I got here. But that being said, so my concern is that the people that you do have would are working harder and for the same pay, and ultimately your attrition rate may go up because of it. So what as a board can we do to help either if you think it's a speed to decision process, if that would help, if that's the answer, what is it we have to do to get that down to a less than a 10% issue?
So for this conversation, may I ask Linda Sen to join me at the table to address some of these points because she has been actively involved on recruitment. And one of the things that we have adopted here is we have an HR manager. Megan has already had, before she joined us, Megan Schultz is our HR manager, which we brought in with the retirement opening of Linda Sen. And she had already prearranged travel during this time for this 2 weeks. So she's unfortunately unavailable.
She's still here.
She's still here.
Yeah. Yeah. We're trying to get to the chaser, right? Hi, Linda.
Hi, Dana. I'm not used to being in public sessions, and forgive me for my informality.
No worries.
I've been asked about the challenges of recruiting. Obviously, Alan has shared with you, it doesn't make any difference what industry you're in right now. Finding help is challenging. Our particular challenge is trying to get the approvals through the administration. And we have worked with Commissioner Sandy to try and grant us authority to be able to make those expedited decisions internally, but we have not been granted that authority yet. And so we're hopeful that it might come through, but as each day passes, I'm thinking it's not going to come through. And it means that we constantly recruit to refill positions that we couldn't fill before because we've lost candidates. Well,
the other thing is that we're on a cycle where you've seen some cases with our shared services that there's a dire need. We're in the middle of an audit. We're just starting the audit process and having the support that's there. And what we have is a history in cases of identifying participants as far back as January. And in the meantime, we've lost them because they are, again, very well qualified. They're a high-demand area. They need employment, so they go to who's paying them the most at that point in time. We restart the recruitment process. We identify someone. The same thing occurs. We're now on our third candidate to come in that we have put forward.
Here's a timeline now. Give me a timeline. From the time you identify, you know, how long does it take before you advertise, how long do you advertise for? Give us. I have no idea how long with this dealt here. Yeah, give me the process.
I will give you a general idea of time frame because each position is different.
So can you back it up to from the time you know you have a person leaving to when you can actually begin to advertise the position description so they get the
position? Well, even sooner than that. How long does it take internally for you all to decide to get a position? I mean, you got the PCNs, so I assume if you have a PCN, that's approval, right?
Right.
Okay, so you have 19 or 20 open mm-hmm. positions. So
we're nearly recruiting for every one of those positions.
Yeah, if I open up the paper or wherever, there's going to be 19 or 20 positions.
You're not going to see that.
Again, then if If I can make sure that we're clarifying, this is getting misunderstood broadly in discussion about ADA, is that you're talking about 19 to 20 positions that are across the organizations of ADA and AEA.
I understand.
I know you understand it, but I'm not really asking to make sure that it's clarified that way, so it's understood.
It's the same thing. I mean, so are you advertising for 19 or 20 positions right now?
Nearly all of those positions we are recruiting for. There are just a few in there that we aren't, because they were originally flagged for one position, and we've decided to go the contract route with a couple of those positions, so we haven't reallocated those. It's the ambulance position.
I'm going to go back to that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So just really broadly.
That's the story.
Really broadly, the process is once we know that somebody is leaving our organization, we work with the manager to make sure we're dealing with an updated position description, because jobs evolve. And especially if somebody has been in the job for 10 or 15 years, it has changed from long ago. So it gives us an opportunity to refresh the job, and then we get it on the streets as soon as possible.
How long does that normally take?
It could take 2-3 days.
Oh, okay.
Unless the position description needs to be changed.
Right.
There can be delays in that, because if you change the PD and somebody doesn't approve of that and they kick it back to you, there can be lag time. But we're lucky because we've got Linda, so she's got this kind of grief, so let's just pretend that's no problem.
Right.
Yep. So then we put it out on the internet, and we do play around with titles, because the title that government uses isn't always the title the private sector uses. So we play around with the title that we use for recruiting to make sure we attract the right talent. And sometimes we have a miss. So after a few days, if we don't get any hits, we start tweaking further. So we are constantly looking at how our ads are being received on the other end, so we can adjust accordingly. But the longer the list you get for open positions, the harder it is to give each position that kind of attention when you're stretched thin. So it does take a while. It'll take 2 weeks, maybe even longer, before we have even a viable candidate coming through that we're interested in interviewing.
We'll call it 1 week plus 2 weeks, okay? Keep going.
Another couple of weeks of interviewing.
Okay, that's plus two.
And then you have reference check time.
So you're saying it's 2 weeks for posting, right?
Yeah.
So you have to be able to say specifically, Dana, how long you're posting for. Are you posting for a minimum of 10 days?
We don't have to do that. Ours are continuous recruiting.
Okay, great.
And so it is open until filled is how we run all of our recruitments. And so if after 2 weeks we don't have good candidates, those ads keep running, and we refresh them about every 2 weeks playing along.
Have you done interviews?
We're doing that. We do the interviews.
How long does that take?
It can take about 2 weeks to get through all the interviews, because, again, all of us are busy when you're trying to find enough time for everybody to get together.
25% already.
Yeah.
Those 2 weeks, okay.
Okay. And then
how long do you get the candidate to decide?
Do you have to request permission to hire once you select a candidate?
We do a verbal offer first, and we let them know that it's contingent on the final approval from the governor's office.
So it's critical to identify the fact that when we submit it through the process internally, these are parties that have accepted the position.
Yeah.
How long before you require a verbal offer to come back?
A lot of times they tell us right over the phone, immediately.
Average?
Usually a day.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right, then how long? So then you go, so the governor's office has to approve it?
Mm-hmm. So then we have to request information from Juno what the full cost of the position will be.
Julie's office, or does it go directly to?
It goes through Julie's office first, and we document it to her.
I'm embarrassed to say sometimes it can take a couple of weeks if I miss it in my email or something, you know what I mean? We have challenges, but we've got those sort of figured out. But that can take a couple of weeks to get along.
Okay, and then does it have to go to the chief staff?
It goes through OMB.
Okay, how long for OMB?
Well, our last group got kicked out, and we've been sitting on them. They've been sitting on them for like,
you need to just take a deep breath before we get to this next one. I'm not kidding.
Okay.
Let me take a recess and have a private conversation. We're getting into some details mm-hmm. here that is not necessary to discuss publicly.
But so anyway, let's just say, overarching between the commissioner's office and the other processes that are involved, there can be delays, and then also there can be...
So you're not gonna, I'm not going to get to how many weeks it actually takes.
No. Yeah.
No. 2, 4, 6, 8, 9. We haven't got to OMB.
I will tell you, for the HR director, it took 45 days.
Do what?
The HR director, once we got a verbal acceptance from her, so Megan, it took 45 days to get the final approval come across her desk.
5 weeks.
She can't start until after you get
approval. Okay.
Correct.
So we'll just call 5 weeks.
So in fairness to a brand new commissioner, Commissioner Rana, who is the commissioner, the new commissioner of the Department of Administration, this is absolutely on her priority list. She hears us loud and clear. Now, some of this is outside of that, though, and that's sort of where I know that I am working closely with Alan and Linda, and we'll be continuing those conversations, and I have not given up on that. I anticipate that we will be able to we will figure out a solution to that tail end of it. But the Division of Personnel stuff is over on this side, and Commissioner Verona is also on top of that.
So there's 14 weeks.
At least.
3.5 months. Well, and I know why you've got 23% efficiency, you know, vacancy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Dana, I think it's important to say that the part of the process that ADA enjoys and AEA enjoys in their hiring process, other state agencies do not have the expedited version that they have.
Mr. Chairman?
So we're better than everybody else, but we're still 14 people. Go ahead, Randy.
Some question for you. In order to bridge that, I understood earlier in the conversation that we had the ability to use contract employees. Would we be able, pardon me?
Only Ada does. Ada just already does it, according to Curtis, but then we'll go to that later.
So if that's the case, as Albert suggested earlier, there's more than one way to skin a cat. So, is it possible for us to use a contract to bridge that time?
Linda, Alan, what do you think? Can you do that? I mean, it's cool to use if you can help. They get hurt, I don't know.
So we do use contract employees. Ambler is a prime example.
But I think that's
project related.
But I think for the purposes of this discussion, it's sensitive also. And I think we just want to be really, really careful. So regarding hire and the delays, I think we've answered those questions for the board in terms of where the delays are, and we've also provided some insight, but I am working closely with Alan and with the administration on how we can solve this up. Because what I heard loud and clear today is at close to 25% vacancy rate. So the sweet spot for state agencies is 3-7%, or at least that's what it was, you know, before. We are used to and budgeted for somewhere between 3-7%, and just the built-in delay, that's where you're always at. The 25% you really get to a place where you can no longer carry out your mission. And so if that's the information that really just needs to be relayed.
What I'm trying to get across to this board is the fact that we are carrying on with our mission and we are delivering on that mission because we have very high quality staff that is here. They are doing above and beyond, and I would hope that this board please recognizes that point. And from the standpoint of how we're looking to address these vacancies that are identified here, we are actively recruiting. We have expanded the HR side from it to have someone specifically on recruitment to where we have identified people that are coming through that meet the experience levels that are here. And we're looking to do it through permanent hire because that's how we maintain sustainability as an organization. If there's other views of this board about how we specifically do it, I would suggest that we not have this discussion the way it's going on at this point in time, because this is fundamental to our operation, and we've identified with Commissioner Sandy what the solution is, and we're pursuing that solution to have permanent staff in place.
Well,
I would please ask that we discuss that.
I think it's very important that I clarify, Alan, that at no time as a board are we trying to convey that we do not have the utmost respect for the staff and the work that they do and how hard they work and how hard they have been working, especially during the session. Mm-hmm. That has been miraculous on many levels. And so I think every member of this board at some point or another during comments has shared how impressed we are by the professionalism and the work that's happening.
Can we please take a recess?
Yes, 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 yes.
What are we recessing for? Yeah, I just said we can recess. Yeah.
Chair.
We'll recess for 15 minutes.
Chair, are you on the record?
Thank you. I'd like to go in executive session to discuss organizational chart. I'd never be.
This is Bill Kindig. I move we go in executive session to discuss the organizational chart.
I'll second. This is Albert.
Thank you. Further discussion, any objection? All right. We'll be on for 15 minutes, Randy.
Chair, you're on the record.
Thank you. Well, I call our executive session over with and make the comment that nothing was discussed about the organization server. No action was taken by the organization while we're in executive session. You don't have to say anything?
No,
I'm just going to say anything. Oh, all right. Thanks. Okay. So, I would like to clarify a couple things. Apparently, maybe some of my comments were taken out of the wrong way of what my feelings were earlier today at our previous meeting and this meeting. In no way do I want to disparage or in any way mitigate or think anything less of the valuable employees of both Alaska Energy Authority and ADA. My personal opinion is that you guys are doing a Herculean event. Accomplishment with the limited tools you have. I think my focus and the board's focus is to give you the tools necessary and the support necessary in order to accomplish your mission. And today was, as far as that's concerned, from my perspective, I think you guys are stepping up to the plate. It's a hard environment to get employees, and my goal has never been to diminish what you do. My goal has always been to give you the tools and be able to be successful. So I want to make that clarification first and foremost. I will say that I get a little frustrated because when I look at the percentage of vacancies, immediately as a business owner with valued employees, I think how stressed and how much work everybody has to do to keep the mission going. We as board members are here to help for that mission. We're here to facilitate whatever we can, advise, put policy in place so that you're successful at the mission. By no means are we here to disparage or to say that you're not valuable or that we should bring in, I guess, lack of a better term, contract employees and more money to do the same thing. That's not the idea, at least from my perspective. I will look for the board's comments.
I just want to echo the chair's comments and just add that we were just trying to help see how we could fill in. We recognize that staff is overworked. That's easy to see. I came on this board in 2019. There were a lot of problems, and I made this statement in the past. Alan and Curtis both have shaken things up. And compared to what was there when I came on the board, both sides have what I call a dream team. But they are overworked, and I'm sorry the message got misconstrued. We're just trying to look for ways to take some of that burden off the staff.
Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead, Randy.
So I haven't been on the board, but this is my third meeting, I believe, and I continue to be impressed by the professionalism displayed with the internal resources within this body. I just find it refreshing to find people that are so dedicated to the mission. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Randy.
Chair, if I may make a comment?
Certainly.
I do appreciate the clarification that you provided there, and to me, it is clear the intention here is how do we actually fully facilitate the mission that we have, how do we fill the positions best, how do we go forward and keep this organization sustainable, and I do recognize the fact that that is the full intent of each and every board member here that you've expressed to me on an ongoing basis, the intention there, and yourself and your own dedication to that. What I would like to ask is to be able to take up what you had raised before about the opportunity to raise issues with board members to help us in that process with the communication. And that's really one of the ways that we initiated discussions with Julie Sandy. She happens to be in the position, or you know, Commissioner Sandy, she happens to be in the position of Commissioner for DCCED, so it helps facilitate that side. But we do also need your help, each and every one of your help, in the process of that, of how we do fill this out and we make the organization fully sustainable.
Any further comments? All right. We'll move on to the loan dashboard report.
The chair, board member, with the board members, what we have is our monthly report on the current status of our loan participation program. And I do would ask if Tiffany Jansen is here, who is our commercial finance director and happens to manage directly the loan participation program, she would join me to be able to address any specific questions that you have. What I would draw your attention to and is a particular focus of ours. Well, first, let me identify the fact that on page 7 of 13, also for the public that has access to this information, what has been provided now is following the discussion that we had in the prior board meeting for determination of the risk management policy with the loan participation program. This is now the follow-on that reporting that Tiffany has put together with her and her team based upon the repayment industry and the exposures that we have within the loan portfolio. So it gives you those data points. Again, I want to express the fact that with Tiffany's involvement, her team's involvement, we really have been able to boil down to some key areas of data that is a very precious element within the function that our loans do. It's enabling us to be able to report better information to identify specific issues that lead us to being able to make better decisions from a risk management standpoint. So this is follow on from that. I do want to identify that this report was manually put together, I believe, from the information. Is that correct?
That is correct. So we are still working with our software engineers. We've exceeded the limitations of our current where we house all the information for the loan. And so each time we add another category to search a loan by or to categorize the loan portfolio, we have exceeded that. So we're now working on that to get it done automatically in the future. But this was a full hands-on deck to get this report going forward. And it's got a lot of information on it as far as highest concentration region for those industries. No industry is above the 25%, and that's indicated at the bottom left. And then there are top five industries that you can see where that adds up as well. And I did want to mention briefly, we had talked at the last board meeting about the boundaries that were set for the region.
Yes, if we could please do. You had a question, Chair, about why we were defining it with a certain region. So we did do research on that and follow up, and Tiffany has that information.
Right. So it's set by the state Department of Workforce Development. They have set the region, so and very indicative of including Nome in the northern region. So it is set by them, and so I think my opinion is to keep with that. I don't think we want to have one that's just individual data. We're trying to get to a more standardized measurement. So we would be the only department agency using if we did recategorize our regions.
So hopefully that gives some definition as to why it was defined that way historically. So it's the way that it was detailed to us to start defining the information.
It's how the state gauges our population measures.
So what I would like to add, right, we had the conversation about with the organization and ways that we're making things more productive at the same time and more efficient for our staff. It's ultimately getting the digitization, direct systems access to our data is a key element of that. There's a lot of time that has been spent really trying to transition that process internally, the automation of a lot of elements of our systems, the way that we do reporting. So previously, and I think I've identified this too, that everything was on paper and was managed that way. We have been very, specifically focused on how do we automate that process and have more access to our data, more functionality to that data. And what I've really identified is Tiffany Jansen and Morgan Ness have been very focused on that, have been advancing that quite a bit. So we'll see more efficiencies come into play as well with that as we transition the organization from how it was administered before to how we're really looking to update our systems now. The other element that I really want to also identify is we've been really quantifying again, this is an element of having access to your data, being able to quantify our delinquencies much more efficiently, being able to report on that. That's extremely important to any type of access to capital markets that we would be seeking in our own operational administration. So that has also had a lot of attention, and what we're able to really identify and you'll see on an ongoing basis is that there is an issue that we're currently addressing with one particular loan participant bank, which is KeyBank. We've identified before that their loan servicing center is not based in Alaska. It's based on the east coast of the U.S. They are not directly administering those loans in Alaska. And so we're seeing the results of that. And we're having to get directly involved. So that's a higher cost for us in the way that we're addressing that. And we're looking at how that impacts our service agreements that we have in place with KeyBank. Now, they're not doing any new loans with us, but it does impact the existing loans that we have in exposure. And we're going to look to see how we can address this particular element of delinquency. But that is really where it's getting concentrated right now. Tiffany, is there anything else that you would look to highlight for the board?
I think just something very positive. We have digitized 100% of the active loans. So we've gone away from paper, and they're now all electronic. So that's very exciting. Oh goodness.
Mr. Chairman.
Howard.
Thanks, Tiffany, for this report. How many loans do we still have outstanding that have been modified, and when will they end? Can you point me out to that?
Yes. So we actually have six loans that are listed on here. That is in the red in your confidential packet.
Oh, okay, thank you.
We won't be able to talk about the borrowers, but
yeah,
we can say
yeah.
that we do have some that are ending also.
So the one that ended on 4/1/22, they have paid for 5-1? They have started repayment for principal and interest for 5-1?
We have not yet pulled all the reports for that, so we're still getting remittances for our payments for May. So we'll pull the final for that in the first few days of June. But as of right now, I've...
To get into some discussion on this, we would need to go into executive session.
We're not, but we're not discussing any specific borrower. You're the boss, Al.
Let's take a 5-minute break and we'll talk it out.
Carrie, you're on the record.
Thank you.
We're still on a loan dashboard. So, to finish up with that.
I have no further questions, Chairman.
Thank you, Albert.
Mr. Chair, I'd just like to thank Tiffany for the additional detail on the loan analysis that you've had to compile by hand. Like you said, without the benefit of having a program do it, because that's exactly what I looked at the last time I looked at that report and was going to have had questions that are now answered, so thank you.
Thank you, Tiffany.
Thanks,
Tiffany.
Thank you. Well, next up is quarterly report to the IEP.
So, Chair, we've attached the Interior Energy Project Report, which is required under Senate Bill 23 and House Bill 105 to be provided to the legislature on a quarterly basis. So you have the most recent quarter that was provided. We were not able to add this to the agenda for the April meeting because the report was due as of April 30. Our meeting was on April 25th. So this is just providing the report that was delivered for that quarter.
So in an overview, how are they doing compared to their performance?
The information is in there directly on the report. So you have two elements of projections that were in place. You have what was IGU's
management. That's all.
They are on track. They're actually a little bit ahead on track of management's own projections. The initial Cardinal projections were let's say, more extensive, looking at more advanced connections would be in place. But again, management's projections, they are online, and that's what they're reporting.
Okay. All right, so that brings up the next
I want to thank the staff for the acronyms list.
And the gas?
Yeah, that's where I get in trouble keeping up. Thank you for that.
Okay, so the next regular meeting is June 29th. Is that correct? Okay. All right, that brings us to board comments. Any comments? Bill?
Well, it was quite the meeting, and I hope that we can clear up the misunderstandings. This board is very impressed with AEA and ADA staff on both sides. We watch and see how overworked they are, and all we were trying to accomplish was how can we help? And that got really misconstrued and misunderstood, and we hope the staff, like I've mentioned it more than once, you and Curtis, since I first got here, have assembled the dream team. It's easy to see. It's explanations, everything. It's coming forward. You guys are putting together good staff. We're just trying to. All we were trying, maybe we were getting a little impatient, but we're trying to help you accomplish that. That's it.
Thank you, Bill. Randy, do you have anything?
I was trying to find my mute button. Pardon me. No, I think between what you gentlemen and what Julie had to say, I'm really good with our progress and going forward, and appreciative of staff and management. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Randy. So, do you ever make any comments?
I just look forward to working with Alan and the team to do whatever we can to collaborate and provide some relief in terms of some of the delays in hiring. I know that we're not the only agency in the state that's struggling with that, and I know that there's also just a national workforce shortage, but I'm really looking forward to getting to a place where we can improve things. And I also just want to say thank you to the staff and for everything the staff does. The agency does really incredible things towards our mission and makes me really proud and has made me proud since I joined the board 3 years ago. And I just really appreciate the staff that hang in there to do that work.
Thanks, Julie. So, I guess backing up, I too want to thank the staff, and by no means do I have any intentions of diminishing what they do and how hard they work. And if that was taken by any stretch of what I said, I apologize for that. 8 years ago, I came on this board, and kind of my mantra is, if I participate, I want to contribute, I want to make a difference, a positive difference, and that's very important. It's also very important that employees and leadership in any organization have trust in their leadership, and that they fully support the mission, the leadership supports the mission, and the people that do the work. So I'm very sensitive to that. I'm very appreciative of the organization, both ADA and AEA, what they've done. It's a great thing. As an enterprise business, we're second to none. Everybody should be proud of what they do. Unfortunately, sometimes maybe we get the cart in front of the horse. Sometimes, we maybe put too much on staff, and what we're trying to do is misinterpreted. But the intention, don't let anybody know that the right intentions are there. And so, I think what's really important. Again, I go back to participate and contribute and make a positive difference. If you can't do that, and if you can't have faith in your leadership, whether it's a board member or it's your executive team, then that's a challenge. So I will say that this is my last meeting, and I'm going to be resigning from the AEA board. I think that after 8 years, it's important that the staff have faith in the leadership. After today and the unfortunate comments were taken out of context, I think it's important that gets put aside, and that the mission is continued, and that there is no way that gets diminished. I appreciate working with everybody. I appreciate with this board, previous boards. But at the end of the day, the staff's number one, very important. Their mission is important, and they've got to have trust in their leadership. And today, what I said, the right way or the wrong way, at the end of the day, the results are that there is some question about that. So with that, I said thank you very much. Go ahead, Adam.
I understand where you're coming from. I would encourage you to take some time to reflect before resigning from the board. I've only been to a few meetings, but I've been to a few meetings over the years. So I think this is the fourth meeting I've been at where you were the chair. And you always come prepared. You ask good questions. You're interested. And you have a background that lends itself to the mission of the organization. And making a misstep in a meeting with the statement that's taken in a way that you didn't intend, in my view, doesn't overwhelm those attributes. And so that would be my two cents is don't submit your resignation rashly. Take some time to reflect.
Thank you.
Yeah. I would also hope that we've had a long day. We've had lots to discuss, and I think that it's really important to take time to reflect, and it would be a tremendous loss to the state and to the organization. And so I would hope that you would reconsider that.
I feel the same way. I'm going
to be reconsidered.
Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, Randy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have total and complete confidence in you, your ability, and your leadership in this organization as chairman. I am very pleased to serve with you, and I think the void would be something that I wouldn't like to see. Please consider what your words were about resigning, and changing those would be really good for me. And I think it'd be good for the organization. It's a, I know you didn't offer it as a gesture. It takes a heck of a man to do what you just did, and I recognize that, and still would appreciate your leadership as chairman of this body. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Randy.
Mr. Chairman, if you think about everything that we have gone through since myself, Julie, and Bill have been on this board, extra board meetings, extra committee meetings, the 1002 area, the COVID relief assistance money, which was, it was a very hard program to put into place and administer. We've done a lot together, and that's with you at the helm. And I hope you'll take the time to reconsider, because today is just a combination probably of a lot of frustrating hours that the staff and the board have put into this organization. But, people can move past that and get beyond that. And it's a lot harder to, it's easy to leave, but it's also a lot harder and more meaningful to stick around and build back relationships or continue to show that you are a leader in this organization. So I would ask you to please reconsider, because we do need your valuable input and different perspective than all of us. And so I hope that you will take some time to consider walking back your resignation.
Yeah, I'd like to add some more. I mean, we have been on the board during this time, and I couldn't imagine us getting through some of these tough decision makings over the last year, especially through COVID and everything else, without your leadership. And there's going to be more tough stuff coming up, so please reconsider. Don't leave the state.
Well, I appreciate the board's confidence. I mean, and it means a lot. Believe me, it means a lot. But there's another side of the coin, and that's staff. And they execute the work, and they've got to believe in their leadership, right? And so I'm very proud that in 8 years I've never missed a meeting. Not one. In person every time. And the reason is because I do care. You know, I'm committed. I want to do the right thing. I want to make a positive difference. I guess I do question if it's positive now because of the fact that, you know, we cannot have staff thinking that they're not supported and that their mission isn't important, their compensation is important, that we're trying to do the right thing. And that's really important also. So at the end of the day, it's a balancing act. And again, I do appreciate your response. I will, I guess what I'll do is I will defer this until I have an opportunity to talk to both Curtis and Alan after they get feedback with staff. But at the end of the day, I'm just one person, and this is an organization made up of everybody that makes a whole, and that's really important to me. So I think but I do appreciate the board's support. But it really, they need the support of the staff. And it's the staff, they're doing 120 or 150% right now, and it's very frustrating for me. And I'm one of those guys that I like to compete, but if I see a wall, I'll go through it. I have to get to where we have to go, and
I don't want to see more people leave the organization, valuable people. And I'm concerned about that, and I presented obviously in the wrong way. That's not my intent. But I can't have staff worried about what the hell the chairman's doing and his thoughts or thinking that I'm not fighting for them. That's paramount number one importance. Now,
Chairman, make a comment, please, just to address what I was saying and really raise it with the board. I'm saying you'd be a constant advocate for everyone that's within this organization. I have seen you and having direct conversations about how it is that we identify and retain staff and keep the organization going. And from the standpoint of the projects that we're undertaking, the advocacy that you and your time has been involved in, I would join the board members in everything that they have addressed and asking you to please reconsider, because you're a key component in ultimately what this organization is able to do within the state.
Again, you know, I'll defer till I visit with you and Curtis. I do not want to be a liability with you and your staff. That's number one. You can't have that. So that makes sense, everybody.